Coming to you live from my apartment, it's Rob Has a Podcast. And now here's the guy who, if he ever dumped out his bag, would have no idols, but so many chargers and wires. I am Rob Cesternino. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Rob Has a Podcast. Oh, I'm so excited for today. Winners of War. Can you believe it? Look at us. We're here. So exciting. Season 40. Really great episode this week. So much fun to talk about. Had a blast on the know-it-alls last night. And I'm really excited today to talk with Jamal Shipman, one of my favorites from season 39, is going to be here to talk with me. Well, he's not going to be here, but he's going to, you know what I mean. He's going to be on the podcast and we're going to talk about everything that's going on here in episode 2 of Survivor Winners at War. So fun. I woke up this morning. I was like, kids, we're going to watch Survivor Winners at War. It was very, they were into it. They said, Dad, is Tyson going to get voted out? I don't know. We have to watch it. They love Tony's Ladder. It's so much fun, Survivor, right now. Thank you for being here. I'm really excited to have you back with us. Another exciting week. Ream Daly is going to be on the feedback show this weekend, so be on the lookout for that. Then we're going to get into this week in Survivor. Taryn Armstrong is going to be with us, plus the Wiggle Room. Get your Wiggle Room, your wand offs in for Monday, and everything else we have going on with Why Danny Lost. Might be a quick one this week. And then, of course, then we're going to get to the B&B as well. Check out with Mike and Liana at the B&B, and Taryn's Survivor Update is recording today, so that should be up by the time you're listening to this podcast. All right, then before we get to Jamal, let me just quickly take a moment and thank our sponsor. Those are our friends over at ButcherBox, because ButcherBox is great because they are going to ship a curated selection of high quality meats right to your home. So many great things you could be making for dinner, like a delicious steak. I like to break out the cast iron grill and it works great. Couple minutes on one side, couple of minutes on the other side. You could put it in the oven too. It's going to make a great steak. All sorts of things you could be doing with your ButcherBox because all of their meat is free of antibiotics and added hormones, and each box has 9 to 11 pounds of meat, enough for 24 individual meals. It's packed fresh and shipped frozen and vacuum sealed, so it stays that way. You can customize your box or go with one of theirs. Either way, you get exactly what you want. It's such a no-brainer. You get the best meat shipped right to your door, which means one less trip to the grocery store, and you've got great options like 100% grass-fed and finished beef, free-range organic chicken, heritage pork, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, my favorite, and then bacon as well, that's free of nitrates and added sugar. It's the way that meat should be. ButcherBox is the most affordable and convenient way to get healthy, humanely raised meat. With ButcherBox, you get the highest quality meat around for just $6 a meal, and they even have free shipping nationwide except to Alaska and Hawaii. It is going to be very exciting when the butcher box of meat shows up at your home. You're going to be trying to pack it all in your freezer. It's going to be a wonderful experience for you. You can get 2 filet mignons, a pack of bacon, plus $20 off your first box when you sign up now at butcherbox.com/RHAP, or use promo code RHAP at checkout. It's not even going to cost you all your fire tokens. That's 2 free filet mignon, a pack of bacon, plus $20 off your first box. Just go to butcherbox.com/RHAP or use promo code RHAP at checkout. All right, everybody, I'm very excited to bring our guest in today. Actually, really looking forward to this one, getting a chance to catch up with one of the standout characters from season 39 of Survivor, Island of the Idols. He spent some time with Robin Sandra, and here he is to talk about this week of Winners at War. Please welcome the great Jamal Shipman. Jamal, how are you?
I am good, Rob Cesternino. What is going on? Man, dreams come true. Here I am on Rob Has a Podcast.
Jamal.
The recap show. This is prime, yeah. Prime real estate right now.
Yeah.
I'm very, very touched and honored that you asked me to do this.
Yes. Well, I'm really excited to be here talking with you. You were, you know, very kind in the lead up to this. And so I appreciate that. That helps my ego, Jamal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, this is wonderful. And I'm just going to jump on the bandwagon because I'd be remiss if I didn't congratulate you on 10 years.
Oh, Jamal, thank you.
Your kingdom here.
Please.
We are all your fiefdom. We are all your peasants.
There's no giant statue of my head around here. Yeah.
Not yet. Yeah.
My wife would smash it like a pinata if that ever came to be. So not yet. That's but Jamal, so what's been going on with you since the end of the season?
Oh, man. Nothing too much, you know, just back into normal life. A lot of people talk about kind of the weirdness that it is to just kind of jump back into the normal swing of things. I mean, the rundown is I started a new job, so I'm. What people might remember is that I did work at an all-girls school in Providence, Rhode Island, called the Lincoln School, and I was an associate director of admission there for 4 years. And the summer after filming finished and before the season aired, I switched jobs, and now I'm an admission product area consultant at a company called Veracross, which provides software to independent schools all across the world, and I specialize in the admission software.
Okay.
So that is my main role. That's what pays the bills. But post survivor life has been really fun, being involved, going to different events. I was at the Jeremy Collins
watch
party. Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. It's so nice to finally be watching Survivor and not being worried about how they're going to portray you and what are people saying behind your back and you know, what are people going to think about what you did and following
it's
the
fun,
Twitter
right?
sphere. Oh, it's really fun. It's really nice to just kind of be relaxed and be a super fan.
Yeah.
I was resistant to the term super fan before I played Survivor, but I'm most certainly a super fan now that I'm watching season 40. So this is great.
Yeah. I saw the coolest video from that first party that Jeremy had where I don't even know if he was if he knew he was being filmed, but somebody had posted the video of that when he's throwing the rings, he comes in and he just aces the three in a row to win the challenge. And then, it was like, the reaction of Jeremy, and he turned to one of his daughters. I'm not sure if it was Jordan or Cameron. And then they were just like doing like a fist bump handshake.
Yeah.
Then Val gave him a hug. That was like a really cool moment to see.
Yeah. The place exploded.
Yeah.
It was so fun. It really had Super Bowl vibes. Like I felt like I was on the home team's, watch party, watching a score a touchdown. Like that place, just every single ring toss, like, toss. And then for him, like, could you imagine being Jeremy at that moment and knowing that that is how that challenge ends? That had to be an incredible feeling.
Yeah. And I'm sure it's like extra cool to like know that's coming. And you don't know what people, tell their immediate family and especially like their kids. But just like even, and my kids were, are much younger than Jeremy's daughters are. But to know that was coming, not like I would be able to accomplish any sort of feat of athleticism in a challenge, but to know that was coming and then be there, with your family to see it. Like that's a really cool moment.
Yeah, for sure. I was a little nervous though because that was after Natalie's boot.
Yeah.
And so while that whole tribal was going on, in the back of my mind I was like, oh man, are we all about to like watch Jeremy get voted out first? Like this is crazy. And I was like, well, why would Jeremy have a watch party if he knows he's going first? But then again, Ronnie from my season did the same thing, and his logic was, yo, this is my only one. Like, this is the only time that I get to have a watch party and enjoy me being on the show. So I was like, oh no, like we get to see Jeremy die here in Survivor terms.
Yes.
But I was happy that didn't happen. Obviously sad for Natalie, but happy that my dog is still going strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you had actually tweeted after the episode last night that you'd said that, okay, great stuff tonight, Survivor. Don't sleep on @Jeremy2Collins. You guys are still doing the don't sleep on? still doing
there's
that?
There's no you guys to this. That's just me.
That's just you. Okay.
That's just me throwing out a little callback to our season.
Yeah. Let me finish, give you the rest of the tweet.
And the rest of the question. Yeah, sure. Go for it.
So you said he had a great episode. He and I were in the exact same spot at this point in the game, and he played it flawlessly off the radar.
Absolutely.
And amassed safety without power. Well done, sir. Okay.
Clap, clap, clap.
Yes. Yep. Clap, clap, clap. So after the, you know, in the first time that you guys had gone to tribal council, that was when Molly, who seemingly was your tightest ally in the game, or at least that's what was perceived by the group that wanted to take her out. Here's Jeremy. And we heard Boston Rob say his name, but it seemed like that Jeremy got very much back in the group of people that was deciding what was going on. As it's weird that I feel like that, yes, Rob and Parvati have gotten all the attention with, you know, with Ethan, but it does seem like that the new school players are controlling what's going on in this group.
Yeah. So here's my take on why I thought a lot about why I think Jeremy is in a much better spot right now than I was when I played the game. And what is happening for Jeremy is everything is falling into the place the way that he would have wanted it to fall into place. So he didn't have to make a move, right? Mm-hmm. Danny Boatwright being the target is great, right? Like, absolutely, right? An old school player. The old schoolers are eating each other. There's no reason for him to intervene. I guarantee you that if the target had been Adam or Denise, I think Jeremy would have felt like he needed to make a move at that point, in the same way that I felt like I needed to make a move when the tribe seemed to try to convince me that the vote was going to be Nora after the Molly vote, because what they told me was that the vote was Nora the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this feeling of, you're not going to get me again with that. Like, you told me it was Nora the first time and it was Molly. You're going to try to tell me it's Nora again, and you think that I'm going to sit here and believe you and just like twiddle my thumbs while the vote is me? Like, absolutely not. So I feel like I have to do something different. I think because the vote was Danny, Jeremy and Michelle and Adam all kind of settled in being like, this is actually pretty good. This is what we would have tried to do anyway. So that's why I think Jeremy's in a really good spot with the way things panned out for him.
We really didn't get to see Jeremy's reaction to Natalie being voted off. And, you know, that's one of the things that, not to pile on the edge of extinction, that we get robbed sometimes of the reaction to the, like, a lot of times that the next episode will start with, or the next hour in the double episode will start with, okay, back at camp after tribal council, what, you know, how was everybody reacting after the vote? Instead, we go right to Natalie next morning next night at the edge of extinction into next morning at the edge of extinction. And we don't get as much of the fallout of the vote. How do you suspect that Jeremy handled Natalie being voted off in the first week?
Absolutely. That's a great point. You're right. Like, that is a one-to-one. Like, we lose the reaction of the tribe coming back from tribal because Edge of Extinction exists. So that's tough. But I think that Jeremy probably handled it like a pro, right? Mm. Because he knew what that was about. He knows what that vote is about. He's a little emotional, especially in the confessionals. He'll give us what he feels. But I think he knows that it's such a social game, and the right thing to do at that point, right, is to say, you got me. Like, yeah, absolutely. Little Natalie had to go. So that's it. Like, thank you for doing that, because I didn't want to have to vote her out myself. It's probably how he sounded anyway. Mm-hmm. So I think he handled it like a pro. I think the tribe knows that he's probably a little hurt by that. You hear Rob in this episode say, you know, Jeremy's at the bottom. Maybe it has to be Jeremy or Ben, right? He's kind of targeting the two of them. But I think for the most part, Jeremy made the conscious decision to decelerate and make sure that he wasn't going to get on people's radar and let the game kind of play out around him, because he knows that spot is like. He knows what that feels like.
Jamal, how did you handle that situation when after Molly got blindsided last season? Then what was it like for you then to go
poorly?
Yeah, you handled
absolutely poorly. No good. No good. And you know what? I defended myself for a long time because here's something that I was thinking a lot about during my season. I was thinking a lot about while my season was airing, rather, not while I was playing it, but while the season was airing, I was noticing that the fans don't allow for the players to have genuine emotional experiences out in the game, right? So they're so quick to jump on you and be like, oh, that was a dumb move. Why would you say that? Why would you do that? Like, you should have known better than to say this and that. And when you're out there, when I was out there, I had a very genuine, honest, regular person's reaction to this idea of like losing a good friend, right? Like, we were there for 6 days, right? We didn't go to tribal the first time. So we had 6 days to get to know each other. I vibed with Molly really well for the whole time. Nobody gave me a clue that Molly was going to be the vote. So one, I'm vibing with Molly. So losing my closest ally was really hard. It was just like a hard thing to just lose somebody that you are thinking about investing in for the next few days anyway, in playing this game. And two, I thought I was close to everybody else also, right? So I'm thinking I'm close with Tommy. I'm close with Janet. You know, I'm close with Kelly. I'm close with Lauren. Like, we're all doing this vote to split the vote between Nora and Jason together. We're having this unified experience to split this vote, have Nora go home and go forward from there. So the feeling of betrayal that instills in you at that point in the game, and just kind of like working through that, that's a very human thing. That's a very like normal, natural response, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I just was really shocked that what that became was, oh, Jamal did a terrible job of reintegrating himself into the tribe. And he didn't do that well. And Jack did it so well, which is true. So that was my bad, right? My bad for thinking that like everyone will make room and space for people to have natural, normal reactions out there.
Yeah.
Because it's not true. That's not what Survivor is. Survivor is a place to be very steeled and very calculated in how you respond and what you say and who you talk to and how you react to the situation you're in. So lesson learned. And Jeremy did a bang up job.
It sounds like that there was a shift for you somewhere along the way. Did that happen as you got further into the game or after the game and are able to reflect on that? Or does that come with then watching it back on television and then seeing, you know, how people reacted to what happened and that's what caused the shift?
Yeah. Oh, definitely watching it. No, watching it for sure. The whole time as I was kind of sitting on what happens in the show, right? Like, I knew all the things that occur. And so while we were ramping up to watch our season back, I was like, man, I am going to be such a protagonist. Like, the whole Survivor universe is going to be supportive of me, and they're going to sympathize with my experience, and they're going to feel bad for me, and they're going to hate my tribe. Like, Vokai is going to be the enemy number one, because they're going to see how wronged I was by everybody else who deceived me and lied to me. And they're going to see me hurting and pining for, you know, my space in the game and my footing. And this is going to be an amazing story for me. Couldn't be further from the truth. So that was my awakening. I was like, oh, this is how Survivor goes. Like, we don't like the people who actually have true emotions. Like, we like to just peg people as being dumb and silly and, you know, arrogant and aloof. And so that was interesting to watch that occur.
Well,
I'm not complaining. I just learned about it.
Yeah. An interesting ride. I think you had, because I think that what, that most of the time, I think that especially in the new player seasons, the fans are usually, I think, on the side of the underdog. And so the start of that season, you know, Jamal and Molly and Jack, they're running the show. They're running the show. Okay. Now you're the authority figure. Okay. We're rooting against you. And then I do feel like that by the time you left the game, you know, now you're in this underdog position. And I think that had a lot of sympathy from the, especially considering some of the circumstances with how you went out of the game.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of things happened to make me a more sympathetic character.
Yeah.
So I can understand that. But I was really, really fascinated by that aspect of the game.
You guys are strangers. We don't. It's not like that this season where we come in and we know who our favorites are.
What? That is an amazing point, Rob, because that is exactly what I'm observing right now. I am hearing a lot of the same things that I said, that other people on my cast did, and perspectives we have about the game occurring right now. And there's not the same kind of vitriol towards them, because they're such icons, right? They're such heroes of the game. That, they hold such a special place in everyone's heart for being winners and for just being such a part of the legacy of Survivor. So that's fascinating too, right? You know, like I was actually just watching a secret scene with Ethan.
Yeah, which one?
And Ethan, the one where he's talking about his you know, being a cancer survivor and how everything is a gift, and he's just kind of taking the time to appreciate all the things about being able to do Survivor again. It's a beautiful scene. Like I'm an Ethan fan for sure, but there is a moment in that special scene where he's like, and I finally got a chance to take a nap. And so I just laid on the sand and I closed my eyes and I just napped, and it was just so glorious. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's like this hero music, and everyone's like supposed to feel so joyous about this, you know, triumph that this guy gets to take a nap on Survivor. Mm-hmm. Do you know the hate and vitriol that I received for taking a nap in the first 6 days of Survivor?
I can imagine.
I was like, what the heck? This guy does the same exact thing, if not more egregious than I did. And people love him for it. So I'm learning that lesson for sure. That it's just a different circumstance for returning players, or for the winners. Okay. I think it's just a different vibe.
Jamal, so I want to ask you a little bit about being somebody who's, you know, so fresh off the show. And so it's been a big part of the story this season about the players that have had a long layoff and whether or not they can adjust to the tempo and the speed of the game now that we're at in, you know, in the year, you know, 2019 and 2020 in terms of how fast the game is moving. Do you feel like is that a big advantage for the players who, you know, as we're talking about the old school versus the new school, the players who have played in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years that they have over these players that have had a long layoff?
No, I think it's all a ruse. I think it's a very simple storyline, right? Old school versus new school. Like, whoa, like, I don't know how this goes. Like, sure, you know, Amber never played with idols, and Yul Kwan was one of the first to play with an idol. And so the game has changed so much. But no one has ever played with Edge of Extinction. No one has ever played with Fire Tokens, right? Mm-hmm. No one has ever dealt with the format that this is going to take going forward. So I think it's new for everyone. And I think it's just this, like, it's this unifying idea, right, that people are trying to use to get into their camps. You see what I'm saying? So you saw it play out in episode one, right? Like Rob, Danny, Parvati, Ethan, they all used that to get together, right? And so then kind of forced this us versus them mentality, which is all the first 6 days of Survivor is. Mm-hmm. It's just an us versus them. And on what line, right? On what axis are you going to create the us versus them, right? You saw Sophie try to do what has happened in the last three seasons straight, which is this nerds versus the cool kids thing, right? Yul is my nerd shield, and it's the cool kids are the poker alliance, and so it's us over here versus them. That's all it is. So I don't actually think that there's this, you know, because the new school. So I'm doing big air quotes. You can't see me, but I'm doing gigantic.
I can hear them. You know, I've done this long enough. I can hear when people are doing that. Yeah.
New school. Yeah. The new school guys are at a disadvantage because they have this reverence for the old school players. players. They're like in awe of Boston Rob, and they're bowing down to the ground that Parvati walks on, right? So, I think there are disadvantages to go around, and I don't buy this like very simple old school, new school trope.
Yeah, I think you're right in terms of that, you know, the game isn't that hard to pick up in terms of like the speed that it's moving at. But I do think that a big thing that I've noticed here with the season in terms of old school versus new school is that I do think that the previous relationships has been a very yeah. big part of what's going on. And I think that maybe with the exception of Yule, who's somebody who is not super active in the Survivor community, I think you've seen people really cling to the relationships that they had before the game started. And I think we've seen very few people that like did not know each other at all before the season started, you know, in any sort of capacity working together, where you see Rob and Parvati and Ethan, people that have been around forever and know each other for, you know, 10 plus years, they're working together. And Adam, who is somebody who's super social and has a lot of connections to different people, you see him being able to work with people that he's met outside of the game, like Ben, yeah. like Denise, you know, Jeremy knows everybody. And on the other tribe, you know, Tony and Sarah and Sandra are working together. So I feel like there that Danny really was at a disadvantage, not so much that the game passed her by, but I think that the really where the disadvantage manifested itself was that she doesn't know anybody and, you know, wasn't close with anybody and didn't have any of those pre-existing relationships with people. And I think really felt like more of an outsider than she actually was in terms of the numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. But here's where you got to be careful, Rob, right? You got to be careful that we're talking about the right things, because that what you just described is not old school versus new school. That's pre-existing relationships versus feeling on the out. And that to me is very real, very real. But even though it's real, we see it play out in a way that is not clear cut an advantage or clear cut a disadvantage, right? I think if you ask Jeremy, his pre-existing relationship with Natalie was a huge disadvantage because he lost his ally, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing with Amber. If you ask her, you know, she's would say that, damn it, Rob, you know, you messed up my whole game.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they're using the old school, new school construction to turn those pre-existing relationships into advantages in some cases, right? So Rob is using it to his advantage with Parvati, right? Et cetera, et cetera. So, or Sarah and Tony are using it to their advantage. So it's just, if you're skilled enough to make what is exists, to make what's real, right, which is the pre-existing relationships, if you're skilled enough to make that an advantage in your own game, and that's the key. That's the people that you see that are in control of the game because they made their pre-existing relationships work for them. And if you didn't do that, you're on the edge of extinction.
Well, can I respond to the Natalie and Amber scenario that you mentioned? Because I think that maybe their lack of the pre-existing relationships was what hurt them. It wasn't so much Jeremy's lack of, you know, existing relationships, but I feel like that Natalie is not somebody who's super active in the Survivor community. I think coming into this season, I think she obviously knows is very tight with Jeremy. She knows Michelle, but I don't think really had any other great relationships with people from outside the game on that tribe. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe that like, sort of led to her being more just, you know, focused on Jeremy. And when it came down to who do we get rid of, Jeremy or Natalie, maybe Jeremy having those relationships is what saved him over Natalie being voted out. You know, that Jeremy had played poker with Boston Rob. And so Jeremy is, you know, a little more active in terms of knowing all these different players. And Amber as well, you know, she is very active with, well, she knows Boston Rob very well. And right. But who else does she really know? Amber. Right. So when it came down to saving Amber versus Kim versus Tyson, you know, maybe it was Amber's lack of relationships, you know, in this world that ultimately was nobody was going to bat for Amber.
I disagree, Rob. I disagree. I think it became Natalie and Amber because of the inherent ridiculous pattern that we see happen all the time with male-female pairs, right? We can't shake ourselves of this. I was actually talking to a good friend of mine the other day, and I could not think of an instance where there was a male-female pair, and the male went home for the reason of splitting up the pair.
Yeah,
there are countless instances of male-female pairs, and the move, right? When the strategy of the tribe is to split up the pair,
yeah,
the female of the pair goes home. And okay. I don't know what that's about.
This
I don't get
is interesting.
That.
And I think, especially, you know,
you know the history better than me. Is there one?
Okay, well, I'm trying to think about this, you know, because, you know, it was something that was, you know, talked about certainly, you know, in your season where at the tribal council where you and Kelly were talking about this, where you know, were vocal about the idea of you being concerned that there was going to be a women's alliance. And Kelly said that,
right,
you know, well,
that's different. That's different. It's not about women's alliance. It's about the male, female duo, the power couple, right? Threat. Right. To fix that, to respond to that threat, the woman has to go.
Yeah.
And that's weird. That's like a weird thing that just happens forever.
Well, in terms of the, you know, the early part of the Survivor games specifically, you know, strengthen the challenges is a factor that is something that, you know, is, you know, who's going to help us more. Often, you know, the male in the male female strategic pair is going to be the person who is going to be able to help more in the challenges. I'm trying to think of scenarios like later in the game where you know it looks like that they have to go after. I wonder if it's a shift, and I don't have all of the, you know, different pairs in front of me in terms of where that happened. But so do you have? Can you put your finger on why you think that it happens that way?
I mean, I think it's, you know, I don't want to get too socio-political, but, you know, I think there's...
We have Jamal here. I mean, we're here.
Yeah, right. We are here. I mean, you know, I think it's a leftover, it's leftover residue, right? It's leftover sexist residue of our society where, you know, the bros look out for each other. Versus women tend to eat each other, right? Like, I was so fascinated by Sandra's pregame interviews where she was like, you know, it's always the case that the women go home first. And guess what? I'm going to be the reason why all those women go home, because only the queen stays queen. I think that right there encapsulates exactly what
people
the
didn't love
is.
That. People didn't love that.
No. No. Of course not. But, you know, it's Sandra being Sandra. And so we forgive it because she's awesome. But it does definitely encapsulate, right, what the core of the issue is. And I challenge anybody to try to make a reasonable argument that Natalie Anderson doesn't strengthen your tribe in challenges. A freaking CrossFit trainer?
Yeah.
Get out of here. Like, she is a beast. And, you know, obviously Jeremy's a beast too, but I don't think that was the sole reason to decide that Natalie goes home versus Jeremy to think about tribe strength. I think there's some other stuff going on there. That's all. That's my hot take on that.
No, it's an interesting point, and I don't think we know the answer for sure. What I was just trying to interject was perhaps Jeremy's relationships with the other players was, you know, there were more people vouching for Jeremy as the person to stay as opposed to Natalie. And it's actually between that pair, Jeremy and Natalie, that, you know, the opposite ends up happening in Survivor San Juan del Sur, where Jeremy is the one, you know, maybe one of the rarer times where Jeremy ends up going home and Natalie is the one who stays and she goes on to win the game.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually a good point. Right. Natalie comes out on the top of that pair. You're right.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about Danny and where, you know, things ended up being so out of control for Danny. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
go for it. Yeah, set it up.
Danny is feeling like she's on the outs. It's hard to say whether or not she truly is on the outs. And Danny had made some comments on Instagram about how, no, the edit got it all wrong. And, you know, one day she'll, you know, be able to tell. We've heard this story before about, you know, the edit rarely ever gets it right. But she, you know, seemed to imply that, you know, no, it didn't go down exactly how you saw it on the TV show. So what do you think was the issue here for Danny, who was seemingly in a safe spot and then sort of scrambled and overplayed her way into being the target for both the old school and the new school alliance that they could agree on.
Yeah. That's a really great question. So here's where I feel like I feel like Neo in the Matrix, you know?
Yes, it's all so easy for you now.
Oh, but like I see the behind the scenes. Like as I was watching the episode, I was like, that's edited. That didn't actually happen in that sequence. Like I'm cluing in on some things that I know about how the show is cut together that helps me understand what was truly going on. It's really fascinating. So being watching the season after you've played the game is really cool. And this is one of those instances. So let's go ahead and give Danny extreme benefit of the doubt here. Okay. Right. Let's go ahead and assume that Danny had some like concrete information or concrete experiences out there to truly believe that she was on the outs, and what might have contributed to that. Right. We had a little hint of it that, you know, Ethan and Parvati and Boston Rob were out on the beach yucking it up without her. Right. And people were passing her and not taking her for walks and cluing her in. I don't know exactly what happened, but I think there was even more. And I'm sure we'll hear about it when Danny decides to tell us more about it. But I think there was even more information that she was privy to that gave her that sensation. Mm-hmm. Right. And so now let's think through her plan. Like if her plan worked, right, she would have amassed an incredible blindside, an incredible upset, right, to get one of the strongest players in the game out of the game. And for some reason, she thought that Boston Rob and Ethan and all of those people, at least five people, including her, were on her side. She really believed that four other people agreed with her. Mm-hmm. So what that tells me is that everyone else is playing an incredible game, right? Mm-hmm. She truly believed that Boston Rob was going to go for it. She truly believed that Ethan and maybe Ben and maybe Adam and maybe Jeremy, like, I don't know who she thought, but there were at least four people who convinced her that this was going to happen this way. And so I tend to balk at this idea that like, oh, Danny was so dumb and she was so clueless and she didn't know what was going on, because all the information she had gave her the impression that people were on board with Parvati going home. And so I tend to give her that leeway in what she thought was happening. She was just wrong. Yeah. That's all. She was wrong about it.
So if I may be devil's advocate, then maybe as the prosecuting attorney in the case against Danny.
Yes, let's go.
She knew seemingly enough about the old school and the new school to, you know, be talking about it and talking about working with the old school players. I don't know what happened with Ethan and Ben. That one is really odd to me in terms of, you know, bringing up the Ben where, you know, Rob talked about, you know, going with the old school thing. So if she was anti Rob and Parvati, like I sort of see that more in terms of like talking to the new school players about this move.
Yes,
why she would go to Rob with the plan to vote out Parvati is kind of beyond me. That one, I don't like. Why would she feel like that there was enough room between Rob and Parvati that she could come in with a plan that Rob was going to go for to vote out Parvati?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the answer there is, while it's obvious to us as viewers that Rob and Parvati were clearly working together, and actually pretty obvious to some other players, I think other players like Adam and Jeremy commented on the fact that commented on the fact that Rob and Parvati seem to be running the game and are such a close pair and all of that. I do think that for whatever reason, Danny was under the impression that Rob was not as close to Parvati as what was true. Mm-hmm. And that to me, this is why, you know, Rob has a freaking head on it on Island of the Idols, right?
Yeah.
Somehow Rob convinced Danny that he was open to working with her more closely than he was open to working with Parvati. And that to me, like Danny's approach to Rob to get Parvati out is more of a testament to Rob's game than it is to Danny's ineptitude or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. I think it means that somehow Rob made her feel like there was an opening there. And that is the mark of a truly great player. So I just want to give that move to Rob, to be honest, because I think that's what's going on there.
So in terms of, you know, Rob and Ethan and Parvati going along with this plan to vote out Danny, it does seem as though that this was a bit of a self-preservation move, because that, yeah, they got the person out that they were targeting. But, in essence, that was a person from their numbers, that the other side has, you know, five and they have three, or they had four. And then they're going to, you know, eat one of their own. And while it felt like a victory in terms of the episode, it seems like that they're going backwards, that they had to they ultimately, you know, sacrificed one of their own to the group to be able to all move on, even though that based on the story we saw, it seems like that their side is triumphant.
And that, to me, what you just described, and this is why I feel like I'm in the Matrix, because what you just described, what that says to me, someone who's played the game the most recently, is there are other relationships out there that we don't know yet, that we're not privy to, and maybe we'll never know them. But think about it this way. Somehow, Rob, Parvati, and Ethan all think that there is a way forward for the three of them without Danny. So somehow they think there is at least three other people, it's going to be eight. Yeah. They think that there's at least two other people three and two will make a majority in an 8-person tribe. They think there's two other people that will go with them going forward without Danny. So they thought they could make that sacrifice. And the question is, who is that? And I don't think we actually truly know. We saw Ethan and Rob talking pretty openly in front of Adam. We saw Ethan and Ben talking pretty openly in front of Danny. So I'm wondering if there's like an Adam-Ben old school kind of fivesome going on, right? That they're feeling like we could make this sacrifice because going forward, there's still an opportunity for us to be in a majority vote.
Yeah.
That's where you have to start analyzing the game. You have to start thinking, okay, if they thought that to be true, what must they feel like is going on that we don't know? And that's where my insight kind of comes in.
So if this tribe is down to 8 people, if I had to guess, I would suspect that the other two, that this group of three, the old school three of Rob and Ethan and Parvati, I'd say the two that they think that they have in addition, I think are Jeremy and Michelle. I think that maybe that they think that, and maybe if you sort of like look at like these potential like trust clusters or whatever voting blocks, I think you have the old school people now. I think you have Jeremy and Michelle, and then you have the Adam, Ben, and Denise. And who were the people that Rob and Parvati were kind of going after at that tribal council? They went after Ben, and they really piled on Ben when he started talking about like, who was paranoid about who, and both Rob and Parvati really piled on Ben there. And then about, hey, who has the idol? And then it was, there was a lot of back and forth between Rob and Adam at that tribal council about, the bag, this is ridiculous. Why do we have to do this?
Rob.
Yes.
Don't fall for the smoke screen.
You think it was a smoke screen?
Oh my gosh. Survivor Universe, don't fall for the smoke screen. Tribal is never as it seems. It is theater 100%.
Okay. How do you know what's theater?
Here's why I think I know this. Everybody, that vote was 8-1.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, something happened that we didn't see that told 8 people who the vote was. And everything that happened at Tribal didn't change that. Everything. Ben going off and doing the whole thing about how the old school was paranoid and the new school is paranoid because the old school is paranoid, and the whole looking through your bags, and Adam saying, oh my goodness, what's the point of this? This didn't need to happen. But like all of that happened. And 8 people decided to vote for Danny.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying?
No, not yet. Because I'm on the edge of my chair.
My point is that all of tribal is a smokescreen to keep the person who's getting voted out comfortable and off the trail.
Mm-hmm.
That's all tribal council is. Eight people knew Danny was going home.
Yeah.
Eight people knew. So what did those eight people decide to do? They decided to perform at tribal in such a way that Danny didn't get a whiff of the fact that she was actually the one going home.
Okay.
So I think it's all theater. That's why I actually think Adam and Ben are more in cahoots with the old school than we're being led to believe with the editing and believing what happened at tribal council. I think that there's this understanding between five people at least who are going to go forward in this tribe of eight and run the show.
Jamal, how choreographed is this? I mean, is Rob saying to those guys before the tribal council, like, hey, hear me out. I've got this idea. Okay. I'm going to tell everybody to empty out your bag at tribal council. I mean, are they to that level? Is everybody on the same page?
That's a good question. I obviously can't know that for sure.
I don't think so.
I think that's just Rob being Rob and performing at tribal council. Mm-hmm. And that's why Jeff loves Rob. But here's my context for this. If you remember way back in second tribal council of season 39, where Molly goes home, what did Jason do? He made a whole show. He dumps his bag out. Guys, I don't have an idol. I know I'm on the outs. Jamal, you didn't even bring your bag to tribal council. And so that's pretty, you know, arrogant of you to do that. And there was this whole back and forth. Molly gets involved. Hey, I'm like offended that you don't think that you can work with me. Like, I really like you. But mm-hmm. like, there's this whole show at Molly's tribal council to get us thinking that it couldn't have been Molly going home. And what happened? 8-2.
Mm-hmm.
Eight people at that tribal council knew that Molly was going home. And their whole strategy was, let's put on this whole theatrics to keep Jamal, Jack, and Molly, or sorry, 7-3, mm-hmm. thinking that the vote is going to be Nora and Jason when the vote is actually Molly. And that's my insight. That's why I think I know that all of that was just a ruse to keep Danny comfortable and not knowing that she was the one going home.
So this is really, really interesting to me because I feel like that we have not really talked about this kind of stuff specifically, at least to this degree before on the podcast. So that's what's great about having people that are right off of the show.
This is the real game. And this is what's so frustrating about watching your season back, because you see people kind of react to the bait and switch. You know, you see people think certain things are true. But you're just like, oh man, guys, like you don't really know like all the other conversations that went on. Like you don't know how much of that theater is really taking place, because can you really trust that when someone says something, that's what they actually think? Or is it that they're saying it to make someone else think that that's what they really think? And that's when you have to really get down deep into the game.
So how much of what goes on is really just for theater? Because, you know, you see Rob get up and get out of his chair and talk to Jeremy. Is this all sort of like the, you know, pre-snap motion that is just there to confuse everybody? And how do you know if something is real that's going to happen at one of these tribal councils?
Yeah, you don't. And therein lies the paranoia of the game. Like when Rob did that, I'm sure maybe Jeremy or someone who's more on the outside of the core decision for Danny to go home might have been like, oh man, like maybe this is a live tribal. Like maybe Ben is about to go home right now because he's talking too much. Or, you know, maybe Denise is about to go home because Rob is suspicious that she has an idol, right? Like all of that could be going on in someone's head, but look at the end result.
Mm-hmm.
Eight people decided to vote for one person. And that is all you need to know about how predetermined and pre-planned and how wedded to a particular plan the tribe was, that all of that happened and still eight people decide to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key to me.
Yeah. Boy, I have to say, Jamal, you really have made a compelling case. I'm still not sure with all due respect, I'm still not completely sold that that's what happened. Sure. that okay. that I just feel like there's so many moving parts there to get one That's over true. On Danny.
Yep. That is very fair. Here's the things to look for then, right? To see if that was the case. See how Adam behaves. Mm-hmm. See how Jeremy behaves.
Yeah.
Next episode.
Okay.
See if they really felt like they were like out of the loop on that, or if that was a surprise to them that they actually came through with that vote. See who, okay, here's the actual key. When you see next episode, who Rob, Parvati, and Ethan think they're voting with at their next tribal council, mm-hmm. that's going to tell you all you need to know about what just happened.
Okay.
At this tribe.
All right. Well, I feel like I need to go watch the episode again. I gotta go at least tribal council. I have to go watch that again, because in terms of the players that voted together at that previous vote on the Natalie vote, you know, that you certainly, you know, Danny was in there. I think it was 7 votes that went against Natalie. So you had the old school people plus then also Ben and Adam and Denise were all on board with that original vote. So maybe there's more conversation than we're seeing.
Ben and Adam and Denise voted correctly 2 tribals in a row. That's not by accident. Mm-hmm. It's not by accident.
Yeah. And also the idea of old school, new school, while it seems like that for us watching the show, it seems like that's all there is, that's completely what's going on here, that it does seem like that at least whether or not it's real or not, it's like, wait, what do you mean? There's an old school alliance, there's a new school alliance, that maybe, you know, on the beach, that's not as clear of a line as it seems to be for us at home.
Yes, Rob, you're finally coming to see it. I think Ben had a very genuine surprised reaction when he heard Danny talking about old school versus new school, because in his mind, there was an 8-person majority or a 7-person majority that he felt like he was a part of. And he wasn't thinking about it in those terms. He just learned from Danny that there was a core alliance of old school that was plotting against the new school. He mm-hmm. just learned that. Saw it happen. And so that to me tells me that they're doing a really great job, right? It's actually a testament to the old school players. They're doing a really great job of keeping the new schoolers out of earshot of their conversations to know what's truly going on inside of their own alliance.
Okay. Jamal, talk to me about the safety without power advantage. So we first heard of it on this U.S. Survivor in season 39. And mm-hmm. so it was something that was offered to Janet. She passed. Boston Rob complimented her on that was the right decision for her to not take it. Was it the right decision for Jeremy to 100%. Buy it for a fire token? Yes.
Absolutely. Not even a thought, right? Like, yes, you do that. You get every advantage you possibly can to not have a possibility that you go home. You know why? Because you don't know what people are doing, right? So when you can guarantee yourself safety, do it.
Yeah.
Right. You know, Janet's concern was like, oh, I'm going to leave my alliance and, you know, they're going to be mad at me if I just walk out. That means you survive on that island for 2 to 3 more days and anything can happen. So do it. Okay. Absolutely. Jeremy made the right call.
Jamal, so tell me, so are you saying that Janet made the wrong decision? Because basically Janet had to make a trade also. Right. Janet had to trade her vote. And I forget, you know, what exactly what round of play that was at. But she would have to trade her vote at the tribal council to get this advantage that. Yeah. And Boston Rob complimented her. And said, hey, you made the right decision.
No, I'm not falling for it. Because look. I do know exactly
that's
when that
mentor,
was.
Your mentor, Jamal. That's your idol. God, you can't. You're not supposed to disagree with Rob.
I wish that I wasn't as starstruck by the two of them when I met them, because they were playing the game as they are. Actually, Nora explains this really well in all her post interviews, where she talks about how Rob and Sandra are villains. Like they were out there as idols or whatever, but they're playing the game. They're themselves, and so they're gonna. They're going to manipulate the game exactly the way they might play the game. And so
they're the serpent in the Garden of Eden trying to tempt you.
That's it. Okay. So Janet, when she denied herself the chance to get the safety without power, it was actually the tribal right before the merge. And we all knew that the merge was about to happen. So let's play out a different scenario where Janet plays the game, gets safety without power. We merge. Kelly goes home. And now it's my tribal. Mm-hmm. Janet should have gotten up and walked out.
A couple of people should have. Yeah.
Because she didn't know that she was going to find an idol. Mm-hmm. She was absolutely on the bottom and was very much on the chopping block, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of me, she got votes, right? That's when she should have used it. So when you can guarantee yourself safety, you take it because mm-hmm. you never know what the circumstances are going to be later on. So that's my take on Jeremy making a great decision for himself.
Okay. So that we found out last night that you can use that until the final 10. Is there a danger? I think so. I think 10 people left in the game. Is there a major danger in misplaying this where if Jeremy is not the person who gets voted out, does he mm-hmm. come across as like a super paranoid or skittish if he just gets up and leaves at a crucial vote?
Doesn't matter at all. Because look, especially in a season with all winners, every single person there understands the paranoia. Every single person there understands that anyone can go home whenever you go to tribal. Mm-hmm. Right. So I don't think anybody begrudges Jeremy for using his safety without power, especially if he feels like he's in trouble. Mm-hmm. Now, how I think Jeremy should play this is either, right, two things. Either play it when you know you're going, when you're on the chopping block, which is completely possible. Mm-hmm. Right. It's possible that Jeremy gets himself in a situation come the merge where he tried to make a big move. It didn't work. One of his allies that he was working with goes home. He's very summarily at the bottom of mm-hmm. the merge tribe, and he could just kind of walk out to save himself. Right. Like that's one instance. Or he could decide to say, OK, I know that this vote is going to be, 8-5 or, 9-1 or whatever. And he doesn't feel like his leaving is going to mess up his alliance. He can decide to use it then. Mm-hmm. My vote would be for the former circumstance, because it's a one person game. So he should just hold on to it until he feels like it will absolutely save his game, and then figure out the aftermath after that. That's what should happen for Jeremy.
Okay. It was a night of advantages and idols last night. So we had Jeremy got the safety without power advantage from Natalie. And then also we saw the twin idol finds of the four halves of idols were found on the episode last night.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to get your take on this because, here's Kim, who is, not in a great spot, like you found yourself in, you sort of around this time in season 39, but you found an idol. And okay, this was like a great saving grace for you that, okay, you might be on the chopping block, but also you found an idol at this point. Here's Kim. She finds the idol. She might be on the chopping block, but it's like, what? You have to give half of it to somebody else? Do you like this, Jamal?
I do. I think me and Steven are on the same page where we like the idea of turning an idol into a social move, right? Because you're right. He's right, rather. You can muscle your way through the game. No better example than that than Ben during Heroes, Hustlers, and the other thing. Right? So. Turning an idol find into
I'm laughing
something.
Because of that I went back and listened to your first one out conversation with Josh Wigler, and unless you're doing a callback, you also could not remember the third H.
I don't care to. That's what it is. It takes too much brain power to remember what all the H's are. And that was the season that I first got to the finals for mm-hmm. and didn't make it, so I have a special resentment. Have a special resentment towards that season.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt, but go on.
I appreciate it. So I'm very happy that an idol find has now like become a very It has to, as it's a strategic thing, right? Like if you're not, so here's the dichotomy. If you're not Survivor, going to make idols harder to find, not necessarily like I don't know that you look for an idol for hours and hours and all that, but if you're not going to attach it to a clue or some kind of like, you know, pick up this idol during a challenge or some kind of effort to acquire this idol, then make the challenge hard to play, like make the idol hard to actually execute,
mm-hmm. right?
Which is inserting it into the social game. Like, I don't like the stumble upon an idol. You can play it at the next tribal and now you're safe. Like, that's just too linear. Mm-hmm. Either make it hard to find or make it hard to play. And that's what I like about the split idol.
Yeah. Okay. So I think I can get behind that, because now if we're going to all complain about too many idols, too many advantages, too many things out there in the game, then, you know, at least now we are starting to devalue the amount of there's too many. We have some sort of like, you know, inflation of like that the trinkets aren't as valuable as they were because we have so many of them.
Right.
So
I'm not. Yeah, sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So we now it now takes two people to save Kim Spradlin than opposed to just Kim having it.
Right. Right. Exactly. Right.
But is there a second person that will save Kim Spradlin if she's going to go to tribal council?
Well, she made the absolute wrong choice, obviously. But the thing that I have like a visceral insight into is that obviously Kim didn't know that was the wrong choice, right? Or else she wouldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. There's something, and this is why you're going to see this theme, right? There is something about how Sophie's playing the game that got Kim to think that she could trust her. So Sophie can say all she wants in a tribal confessional, like, what a dumb move. I can't believe Kim trusted me with this. Like, why would she do this? Blah, blah, blah. But there is something about the way the downtime of the game or whatever, like something is happening between Kim and Sophie that allowed Kim to feel like this mm-hmm. was, there was a relationship there that is trustworthy. Right. So Sophie should give herself more credit that she successfully got Kim to trust her with this information.
So Jamal, if Sophie is the wrong choice, what was the right choice for Kim?
Oh, Sophie had it right. Like the right choice would have absolutely been Tyson, right? Or someone yeah. that she really feels will have her back and want to play the game with her and not feel threatened by her. Like, I think Sophie, if Kim could have made any kind of read outside of the relationship building out in the game, she should have read that Sophie would be more threatened by a Kim Spradlin wolf than mm-hmm. a Tyson have felt towards her.
Yeah.
So you want to play the game with people who would not feel threatened by you to take you to the end. And there's no world that Sophie feels comfortable sitting next to Kim at the end. So she should have read that and not gone with Sophie.
So in thinking about this, you know, we talked about this a little bit last night in terms of giving the other half of the idol to Tyson. Sure, that seems like the knee-jerk correct move to make, because Tyson is the one person who's, you know, seems to be, you know, Kim's clear ally out there. But, you know, if they're both on the bottom and they're going to both be at a tribal council, there, you know, there's the potential of, okay, let's put, you know, four votes on Kim and three votes on mm-hmm. Tyson. Is Tyson mm-hmm. going to be incentivized to play the other half of the idol on Kim?
Oh, that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that. No, thank you for pointing that out. So in a situation where they both feel like it could be either of them, there's no incentive for Tyson to essentially block the majority of votes on Kim when the next majority of votes could be on him.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great point. So I'm in this very moment reconsidering my idea.
Okay, good.
Because I think that's real. I think that's a real concern.
We're having fun. This is like we're throwing a lot of things back and forth, Jamal.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, so it actually takes me back to my point that I think Kim made the right calculation. Given what she understood to be the dynamic between her and Sophie, she couldn't have known that mm-hmm. Sophie was going to react to it the way that she did. So I think I'm, I, I turned out to be correct.
Poker face by Sophie. I'm wondering, though, would Yule have been the better person to give it to? Because the last week's episode ended with that we saw, okay, Amber got voted out, and then Yule sort of like, you know, puts his, you know, hand on Kim's shoulder, or like gives Kim like a reassuring look. And then Yule explained that he wrote like a blog where he talked about, you know, that he was trying to bring Kim into the fold. That maybe couldn't that help protect Kim, where then if Yule has the other half of the idol, sort of like, even I know that Cook Islands was the first season where you got into the show where Yule was able to really leverage that super idol for more power into the game. Could Kim go to Yule with that other half of the idol as to protect me?
That's a great question. I have to answer on both sides of this. One is, great move if you give it to Yule, because you know that Yule's the kind of player who understands that sharing an idol is an act of a bonding, right? It's an act of like inviting you in. However, you have to think about what Kim's experience is up to this point, where she had a very emotional few days, right? Mm-hmm. Feeling like she was bottom, feeling like she was paying the price for being a part of a poker alliance that didn't exist in her mind anyway, right? She says so in the last tribal that she's in. She's like, if there's a poker alliance, I wasn't a part of it. Mm-hmm. And so she, I imagine, understands that Yule is the ringleader of the mob that's out to burn all of the poker alliance. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that she feels comfortable trusting Yule with half of an idol that can only be played to save her if he gives it back to her. Mm-hmm. Right? Like that's a big ask. Like that is a huge ask of Yule, or it's a huge leap of faith of Kim to think that Yule was going to do that for her, given the way that the game has played out for these 6 days. So I answer on both sides, but now that I've talked it through, I don't know that she could have done that. I don't think she could have made that move.
Mm-hmm. And maybe she feels like that, you know, because of the whatever like existing relationship she has with Sophie, even if it's not a deeply personal one, she might feel like, okay, this is just as good that Sophie is sort of like a person who is tight with Yule, and so she can keep me safe as well, and then give her the other half of the idol. But I don't know, it doesn't look like Sophie is super interested in keeping Kim around for that long.
Well, you know, it's what was Denise's instinct, and I'm sure we'll go here next. But Denise's instinct was to try to use the other half of her idol to pull in an adversary, right? Pull in someone who she wasn't working with to try to get the majority. So I imagine that Kim has the same similar kind of thing going on, which is like, you know what? Let me solidify what I feel to be true, because she says so. She says, I always thought that Sophie and I could work together. So she feels that to be true. Let me go ahead and try to make that a thing by doing this. And like I said, she couldn't have known that Sophie was not going to react this way to being shown an idol.
Did you want to get into Denise with her side of the idol? Because we can talk about that.
Absolutely.
Okay. I want to read you a question that we got as we start to bring in some questions from the listeners. One of our longtime listeners, Mike Ramone,
Hey, what's up, Mike?
He was responding to Brent the Shower Man had made a tweet about how, you know, that I don't understand the logic of what Denise was doing with Parvati. Mike Ramone says it was a manipulation technique. Denise wanted Adam to think it was his idea to give it to him. I hope at Rob Sisternino brings this up on the podcast. Do you think, was this a dark psychological tactic that Denise was trying to employ? Was she playing mind games with Adam when she threw out the terrible idea of maybe we should give half this idol to Parvati?
Okay, so that's actually a really great question. Good job, Mike. Here's my take on that. And here's where you have to be careful with your analysis of Survivor. You know the game, Rob, of Rock, Paper, Scissor?
Yes.
right? So let's play this out for a second, because I think this will be illustrative, right? If you know, Rob, that I'm going to play rock, what are you going to play?
Paper.
If you know, Rob, that I know that you know that I'm going to play rock, what am I going to play?
Scissor.
There you go. Okay, so we just did the first two layers of that.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually worked this out on paper. This is how much of a nerd scissor. I am. So if I go back and forth, right? If I go like, if you know that I know that you know that I know that you know that I know, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can go nine times like that, back and forth, to the point where we get right back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. Of you knowing that I play rock, right? So at what point do we kind of not go down that route to say like, well, Denise knows that if Adam thinks that if she was going to give it to Parvati, that Adam would think that it was his idea to do it, then Denise is going to play like she thought it was going to be Parvati, so that Adam thinks that blah, 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 right? Like if you do that too much, mm-hmm. you just work yourself into a very unnecessary loop of logic. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So what I think is more logical is that Denise just actually thought that that was a good idea.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. Adam, I'm with you on that one, because I don't think it's Denise's game. Denise is, you know, I don't think she's playing, you know, nine layer chess. I think that Denise's game is sort of being about like being upfront with people. And I think that she would not be, you know, and somebody that she has a good relationship with, you know, if she looks at Adam as being like a Malcolm to her in this season, I don't see her doing that kind of a psychological like tactic to try to get what she wants out of Adam there.
Right. Right. I think she's a very feeling person. She's a psychologist. I think she just goes with her gut and her feels. And I think Adam, being the wizard that he is, knows how to work that and get Denise to trust him. And now has half of an idol through that relationship, which is amazing, because if you remember the episode before, he does a lot of work to get people off of the trail of the danger of his relationship with Denise. And we're seeing the fruit of that work, because now he has a freaking half idol and nobody is on their trail. So good stuff, Adam.
Okay.
For working that.
Jamal, speaking of fruit, I want to ask you about something that I'm very curious about with playing Survivor in Fiji. There was a lot of talk and a lot of effort for the players to knock down this breadfruit that's going on. I've never heard of breadfruit. I've never tasted a breadfruit, never heard a breadfruit recipe. I didn't know this word until Survivor, and now all these survivors, Tony almost killed himself to get his hands on it. Yule is trying to knock down the breadfruit. What is breadfruit, Jamal?
Yes. Oh, man. It is amazing. I feel like that's one of the successes of season 39.
It's good?
Is discovering breadfruit for the franchise. It's delicious. Unfortunately, you have to know how to cook it, though. You have to know how to cook it. You have to cook it. Yes. You have to cook it. So breadfruit is extremely starchy. It's like a very starchy, bitter fruit, I guess, or vegetable. I don't know what a breadfruit is, but it's very potato-y, but like it's an extreme potato, Rob. It's just a very extreme
potato. Okay.
Yeah. So when you cook it, you have to get it soft, right? You have to kind of like cook out all of that like bitter juices. So there's a method to it that makes it really, really delicious. And we discovered it, right? We pan fried it sometimes, we boiled it in the rice sometimes, and it was very, very good. So I commend season 40 for going through all the effort they're going through to get these things, because they are a life changer.
Yeah.
If you remember Vokai versus Lyro, in the beginning, we were destroying them, blowing them out of the water. And in small part, I think it was because we were much better fed than they were.
Because you had the breadfruit.
We had the breadfruit and we had fire. Almost 6 days before they did. So, yeah.
And does it taste like bread? Can you make a sandwich with it? Why is it called breadfruit?
No idea. Not even a little bit. I'm sure there's someone who listens to the pod who understands more about the anatomy of a breadfruit.
Yeah.
But it's much more akin to a potato in terms of texture, feel, and taste than it is to bread. So I don't know what the bread part of the part.
Okay, Jamal, how did you guys get the breadfruit? I think Karishma said that you guys got all the low hanging breadfruit.
That's what it was. So I'm like watching the season 40 and I'm like, why are they doing that? Like making ladders and, you know, poles with lassos at the end. Like literally I'm 6'3", so I'm pretty tall and I'm pretty athletic. I could jump and grab a breadfruit off of the breadfruit tree. Jack was the climber. So he climbed into the breadfruit tree and got a few down. But it wasn't high off the ground. So like literally jumping from the ground, I could grab like three or four breadfruit. Mm-hmm. So I think Karishma's right. We just kind of cleared it out.
You cleared them out.
for the ones that were on the beach that we were on. So I'm sorry, Tony, but that gave you the opportunity to build this incredible ladder. So
yeah, well, I thought that Tony building the ladder, while it was like a silly scene, that I thought that this was all like best case scenario for Tony, because that this Loved was it. Goofy Tony. This wasn't Tony. Oh, he's a threat. We have to get rid of Tony. This is Tony. He's our lovable clown that we love hanging around. Then we got to see in the next part, you know, okay, all right. He still is dangerous Tony. And now he's back working with Sarah. And are people sleeping on Tony?
Absolutely. Yeah. Can we talk about Tony for a second? First of all, Tony's
one of my favorite subjects.
He's amazing. Yeah. So Tony is a police officer in Jersey City, New Jersey. And Jersey City, New Jersey is my hometown.
Oh.
So I feel very connected to Tony Blackjones. He's great. He's really, really great. And I'm so into like Tony 3.0. Like this is it. This is the way that Tony has the most potential to win this game is goofy, wild, crazy, zany, but like non-threatening, funny, silly Tony, but has the wherewithal to make his alliances with Sarah, even work with Sandra again, right? Like that's awesome. And I'm so excited to see how Tony's game pans out because he's killing it. I'm loving Tony right now.
Jamal, have you ever met Tony?
I haven't. I want to meet him as a survivor player. Mm-hmm. I don't want to meet him as the person who pulls me over on the side of a road. that would not be good.
You know, what an arc though for Tony in terms of this character where that we had like I called him a unicorn in Survivor Kageon, that he was, you know, a once in a lifetime player to, you know, play so aggressively, so just impulsively and be able to go on and get the win. And then he flamed out like no other in season 34. But now somehow from the ashes that this phoenix has somehow risen, and he's just here, I feel like, at the right place at the right time, where I think that so many players, I think that Jeremy really popularized the strategy of okay, hiding behind shields, and I think a lot of players are there, and I think a lot of players want to do that, and now here he is in all his glory to be that shield, and he's also not, but he's non-threatening and he's not menacing in any way, and he's keeping everybody laughing and having fun, and I just feel like that he seems like he's set up so well right now for Tony.
Right. Well, it's so easy to do in the season, like season 40, to do the like hide behind the shields, because there are 20 shields. Mm-hmm. So take your pick and you're hiding behind someone. But for Tony, like it's masterful because he knows his vices, right? He knows what will get him voted out. And he knows what will get him the win, right? So I think he has really like put together different pieces of different people's games. He at Tribal literally says, I'm taking a page out of Sandra's book, anybody but me, right? But here's what you don't think about though, when you think about how Tony's playing the game right now. Tony's not all the way gone, right? Like there's still a little bit of Tony that you see kind of peeking out, and where it came out was when Sandra runs over to a group of people and tells Tony, hey, now the vote is you. And now they're talking about you because you need to go over it in the way that you were a threat. And Tony going into the vote against Amber, truly thought that he was putting together an alliance against Tyson.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so that was an example of how Tony was doing that knee jerk thing that he does, where if he hears his name, then he's like, oh, well, that person has to go. But whatever happened, and this is us not knowing really like how things play out right before Tribal, but whatever happened, it reeled him back in. So Tony's still there. Mm-hmm. He just is able to be reined in a way that he might not have been open to in his previous games.
Yeah.
So that's the difference.
Would you say, is he more like a werewolf or the Incredible Hulk, where that, you know, he sort of has like the two sides of him, but that he can't control when the other side of the personality is going to come out?
Yeah, that's a good metaphor. He definitely the Incredible Hulk, if I had to choose one. I think someone is going to poke the bear. Someone's going to get him angry. Someone's going to set him off.
When I get angry.
Here's the thing. This is why it's so ridiculous to play with these players. Someone is going to set Tony off strategically, and it's either going to be Sarah mm-hmm. or it's going to be Sandra.
Yeah.
One of the two of them is going to have it as a part of their strategic move to get Tony going.
You're right.
And that's how Tony is going to go home, is because someone's going to use him against himself.
Right. At any point, you know, he is, you know, that stick of dynamite, that at any point, either Sarah or Sandra, they know exactly when to light the match to be able to set that whole thing off. And in Game Changers, that's exactly what Sandra did. Sandra ended up getting him all wound up. And I think that only accelerated how fast that he was going to go out. But I'll give Tony the credit in that whatever relationships, you know, that needed to be mended with, you know, Sarah and Sandra, seems like he's done that work where both of them are in his good graces here to start this season. Because if that wasn't the case, then it would be big trouble for him.
For now, I'm not, like I said, I'm not fooled by any of this. I think that Sarah is saying what she's saying because it gets her through the first three votes of this game. And I think Sarah is just chomping at the bit to get a chance to enact revenge on Tony later in this game. Not necessarily in a petty way, right? Not mm-hmm. in a way that gets her off her game, but mark my words, if Sarah sees an opportunity to get the attention off of herself by offering up Tony, she will take it. Mm-hmm. And you already know Sandra's going to do that. So
yeah,
I think Tony's days are numbered.
Well, I was going to say it was a good idea that Kim didn't give the other half of the idol to Sarah, because Sarah would figure out a way to get Kim voted out so she can get the other half.
Oh, that is absolutely what she would do. I mean, Officer Sarah is my inspiration. If you remember my move against Dean, which didn't play out the way that I hoped it.
The legacy advantage.
my whole thought process was inspired by what Sarah did. To try to use the legacy advantage as a way to target someone.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't work out, but I think Officer Sarah is brilliant, and I'll take a page out of her book any day.
She's been really good this season so far. I thought she would be in trouble, and she's been not even mentioned, not even a whisper of let's go after Sarah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Let me bring in some questions here from our listeners. Melissa Elliott wants to ask, which of the Island of the Idols lessons does Jamal think would be the most important for Boston Rob or Sandra this season? Is there anything that they were giving out in terms of lessons at the Island of the Idols that you think maybe they should have been listening back before they went back on season 40?
Oh boy.
All right, how about this? Let's flip it. Okay. Now you get a chance to, before they went out there, they show up at the Island of the Idols and they see the giant Jamal head. And now you get a chance to give them some advice before they went back for season 40.
Sandra and Rob?
Yeah.
I get to give them advice?
You give them some advice.
That doesn't even make any sense. I mean, Not only does it make any sense because they're who they are, but Sandra and Rob are playing flawless games right now. Like they're doing amazing. Okay. They're doing amazing work right now, because think about it. Boston Rob has Amber on Edge of Extinction feeding him all kinds of fire tokens and advantages or whatever is going to happen that benefits him. Sandra just got an idol. I don't know how that worked, but for some reason, somebody thought it was a good idea to give Sandra an idol. Right? I think they're positioned so well to have had such big targets on their back. I think they're positioned really well. What I'm trying to do is imagine what could be the end of them. Mm-hmm. I think the end of Rob could be his knee-jerk reaction to get out the person who says his name. Mm-hmm. I think he has to get used to the fact that everyone is going to say his name, because his whole MO has been, well, if you want me out, then you got to go out. And I think smart, savvy players are going to use that against him. That's not a lesson that he gave out on Island of the Idols, but if I can be an idol on the island, I would tell him, chill out. Like, it's okay. People are going to say your name. Like, it doesn't mean that they have to burn to the ground. And he's actually taking a little bit of that advice, because if he was playing purely the way we know Rob plays, Boston Rob plays, he would have gone after Danny Boatwright day one.
Yeah.
But he didn't.
Well, let's just drill down a little bit on that. Do you feel like that any part of Danny going out here on day six was the fact that she did earlier mention Rob's name, and now was that she had like one last strike after that and then she blew it?
No. I think so much happened. Some of what we saw, most of what we didn't, that got Danny back into Rob's good graces. The straw that broke the camel's back on its own, the one straw, was that she went after Parvati. Mm-hmm. And that makes a lot of sense to me, that Rob was just so taken aback by the fact that Danny would think that that was a good thing to pitch to him, that he was like, oh, okay, well, oh, I was wrong. Like, you are not someone that I can work with.
Yeah.
You're a liability here. If you're going to go after Parvati, you're clearly going to go after me at some point. You got to go. So I think Boston Rob definitely got to a place where he was completely willing to work with her up to a certain point. And that just kind of was like the one thing that he couldn't tolerate at that point in this game.
Well, Jamal, what about the feud between Rob and Sandra that really, you know, season 39, turned out to be like this prequel to what was going to go on in season 40, where
it's so wild.
None of us saw this coming, of that Rob and Sandra spend 36 days together on the Island of the Idols and are going to leave with Sandra with like a blood feud against the Mariano family after.
I don't buy it for a second.
I do. Okay. Tell me why.
I know you think that Sandra is saying all these things to press, and if it was just a ploy, then she wouldn't be so hung up on this thing in the real world. Mm-hmm. But here's, the whole time that we knew that it was Winners of War and that Boston Rob and Sandra were going to be on this season, all of us, the cast of 39, were like, oh, that's it. Like, Boston Rob and Sandra are clearly the biggest targets. They're clearly a pair. They're clearly going to be targeted.
Just to ask one quick question. So you guys knew that after your season was over, not at the time that you guys were playing, right?
Oh yeah, no, not at the time that we were playing. Yeah, we had no idea what season 40 was going to be as we were playing. I'm just saying Boston Rob and Sandra knew that everyone there knew that they were Island of the Idols. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So Sandra, okay, think back to episode one. Sandra goes to Wendell, where's Wendell right now? Wendell's playing an amazing game. Sandra goes to Wendell and says, oh, don't call me queen. That's going to put a target on my back. Like, you can't do that out here. Mm-hmm. Sandra knows the perception of her. Sandra knows the perception of her and Rob. So you see this scene at the well where Sandra and Sarah are talking, and Sandra is going on and on and on. I can't believe Rob didn't tell me. You know, I'm so offended that he didn't say to me that he was coming out here. He lied to me. I can't believe he did that. And look at where she's at.
Okay.
Sarah ate it hook, line, and sinker. Oh, okay. Well, then he lied to you. So you're not with Rob. You're with us to get out the big threats. It is working to the T, and she has the whole country, the whole world fooled that she's actually feeling some kind of way about Rob not telling her that he was going to be out here in Island of the Idols. It was pure Sandra, and kudos to her. Okay. She is absolutely the queen for that.
So, Jamal, this is, you know, we're going back to what we were talking about before with, you know, don't fall for the smokescreen. And this is like exactly the same thing that we're talking about with the tribal council, where you're telling me that Rob and Sandra fighting is just a distraction and that they are in on it to whatever degree. And I don't disagree that it's been, you know, that it's an effective strategy for Sandra to, you know, hey, I'm going after Rob. I have a thing against Rob that everybody saw their giant head statues. Okay, they're the two biggest threats out there. But that is something that I think that clearly helps them in the game. Even when Sandra voted for Amber, she was sort of like, you're a nice lady. I'm sorry this had to happen to you. She didn't give her like the queen stays queen adios. But everything else, well, why does Sandra lie to the audience? Why would she even? I was at a panel the other night where Dalton Ross asked about this, and Sandra said she still has hurt feelings about this, and she's never gotten an explanation from Rob. Why didn't he tell her?
Here's my take on that. I think that this doesn't go. Right. So here the rationale here. This does not go as far as, in my mind, to Rob and Sandra planning this out.
Mm-hmm.
I think Rob is truly surprised at what Sandra's saying. I don't think Sandra planned with Rob to be playing the way that she's playing. And I think Rob actually didn't tell Sandra that he was going to play season 40. Right. So I think all of those things are true. What I don't buy is that Sandra is just playing this emotional game and spilling her like unfiltered heart to her tribe about how she's so hurt that Rob didn't tell her, blah, blah, blah. I think she took what was true. And I think what's true is that Rob didn't tell her that she was playing season 40. And maybe there was some part of Sandra that was offended that he didn't tell her. But I think she saw what was true and was like, I'm going to use this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to use this as a way to convince my tribe that I'm not with Rob so that I don't end up the way that Amber did, because that's exactly what was about to happen.
Okay. So I think that we will get the answer then if this is the case, because if they ever end up on the same beach, that you would imagine that Sandra would not target Rob if what you're saying, if your version of these events is accurate. Is that fair to say?
That is not fair to say. Far from fair to say, because listen to what I'm saying. I think Rob is surprised that Sandra is saying what she's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Sandra's out for herself.
Yes. Okay. Both those things I agree with.
Sandra does not have any loyalty to Rob. Sandra is not trying to get Rob further in the game.
Mm-hmm.
If they merge and everybody wants to vote out Rob, Sandra will be like, well, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Vote him out. He didn't even tell me that he was playing season 40. So mm-hmm. I don't care about him. Like, let him go.
Mm-hmm.
Because Sandra's operating philosophy. Anybody. Right. So I think this is Sandra through and through and through and through and through to just kind of play the facts of the situation. Right. I don't think anything is wrong here. I don't think anything is made up. I don't think anything is a lie, except for the fact that I think Sandra is using it to advance herself in the game versus just, lying to the public about how she's feeling.
So what would you need to see to feel like that this is a real feud? What if Sandra was on the same beach as Rob and she leads the charge to get Rob out of the game? Would that convince you?
No, if she leads the charge to get Rob out of the game, my theory still holds, right? That Sandra is using her lies.
You cannot be shook from this, from your worldview.
I can't be shook for my worldview until Sandra at the end of season 40 says to me, or continues to defend the fact that she actually was feeling this way. Mm-hmm. I anticipate that should you ever get a deep dive with Sandra at the end of season 40, mm-hmm. she's going to say, Yeah, that was me just trying to like make sure that nobody paired me and Rob together, because if we did that, then I was going home. So I needed to make sure everybody.
But why wouldn't she say that now?
Because the season hasn't aired yet.
Mm-hmm.
The season
hasn't
aired yet.
She wants us to be surprised.
Yes. You see it? Yes. She has a reputation. She's the queen. Mm-hmm. She needs you to know that. She needs to keep the suspense, and she needs you to be on her side.
Mm-hmm.
This is the whole game. You know what I mean? Like, this is it. Like, as my season was airing, I was tweeting a little bit, not too much because they really locked us down from CBS publicity. Mm-hmm. But I was playing up some rivalries. You know, I had some tweets for Dean, right? When Jack got voted out, mm-hmm. I had some tweets for so-and-so when things happen, but that's just us kind of playing the game along with everybody else.
I hope you're right. I do. I would like to live in that world.
Yeah. It's cool. Like, I give so much credit to these players. Like, it's so fascinating to watch them work and to feel like I have some insight into why they're doing what they're doing that we, right, as viewers would only know if we knew to like look between mm-hmm. the lines and to assume that everybody has very genuine relationships and has talked to everybody and has their own very smart, thought out plans. It's just that for some of them, it just doesn't work out. So when we go down this road of saying like, oh, Danny's so dumb, like, I can't believe she did that, or Amber really messed up because she did that thing, it's like, no, that's not entirely true. Like, I think they actually had legitimate belief in the relationships they created, mm-hmm. and they just ended up being wrong about that.
Look, and I could tell you from firsthand experience that, you know, that you can look good and you can look bad and you can be the same person. Also, it happens. It happens to us, Jamal. True.
That is very, very true. Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, to take it all the way back, like, there are certain things happening right now that I'm like, they're getting a very different response to some of the same things that happened during our season.
Mm-hmm.
And that just goes to show you that, you know, either your reverence for these players kind of changes your perception about their behavior,
mm-hmm.
Or it's just kind of being portrayed, or the music is different.
Yeah.
Right. When they show you some element of the game, it's really all about perception.
Dan Sinensky wants to know, would you have wanted the Edge of Extinction on your season? So you guys went to go play and season 38 was going on. I think it was probably natural to assume that Edge of Extinction might be on your season. Were you hoping that it was there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Elaine Stott hit the nail on the head. Absolutely. Right? Like, as a player, I would have loved for Edge of Extinction to be a thing so that when I got voted out, I could have a chance to get back in the game.
Mm-hmm.
But now, as a viewer of season 40 and watching how fire tokens are becoming a part of it,
mm-hmm.
I'm actually go against the grain, and I continue to be a fan of Edge of Extinction in this version. I wasn't a fan of it in 38 for a couple of reasons. Here's why. Season 40, everybody knows that Edge of Extinction is a thing. I was not a fan of the fact that nobody knew that Edge of Extinction was a thing in 38. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the thing. It's a big difference. It actually it changes your perception of the game if you know that that's what's occurring. And thing number two, with fire tokens, it actually changes the calculation about what it means to vote somebody out. I'm actually a little confused about why everybody is so up in arms about this idea that you can get voted out and still have a chance to come back in the game. We went through a whole stretch of Survivor where that was the case, right? Redemption Island mm-hmm. was a few seasons.
Yeah.
Right.
This whole, well, I can tell you wasn't super popular at the time either. It wasn't that Redemption Island was a fan favorite.
It was the same kind of criticism, I'm mm-hmm. sure.
But it was not reviled like the Edge of Extinction has been.
Yes.
Correct. And that being said, nobody came back from Redemption Island to win the game.
Yeah, that's true. It could have happened, but it didn't.
It almost did.
It almost did. So the point that I want to make, though, is when Ozzy went to Redemption Island, his whole logic was, let me go, Let me beat out who's ever there as a strategic move and get back in the game as part of my story. Mm-hmm. Now that there's Edge of Extinction, people know that it's Edge of Extinction, and there's ways for Edge of Extinction to influence the actual game. What needs to happen is people need to start strategizing about who to vote out. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, the tribe shouldn't have voted out Natalie. The tribe shouldn't have voted out Amber, because they should have anticipated that what they were essentially doing is making people still in the game stronger.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, they had no idea. I mean, this is the same thing you're talking about with season 38 of the players don't know the rules.
Yes, that's right. And so that's the criticism that I would have, is that I wish that people knew the ramifications of voting someone out and how it can influence the game, because I would like for them to, I'd like to see the process of them figuring that out mm-hmm. and working through it, right? So Jeremy right now is in an amazing position where he understands fully the implications of the implications of Edge of Extinction. And slowly we're going to start watching people figure that out.
Yeah.
I wish everybody knew up front so that people could say, like, okay, well, if we send Amber home, that only means that Amber is going to give fire tokens to Rob. And do we really want to do that and let that be a part of the discussion? You see what I mean?
Yeah. I agree 100%. And for Jeremy, it's sort of like a twofold advantage, where not only is he sort of the first player in the game to be able to sort of like really grasp what's going on in terms of this exchange, but he also has the person who's on the Edge of Extinction, who has, you know, found two advantages. She was only able to send one to him, but Jeremy potentially could have zero fire tokens and an idol and the safety without power advantage if it wasn't for how good he was at the ring toss.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, he could have an idol and a safety without power.
He could have five advantages, Jeremy.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Well, what you know what's going to happen eventually, right, is that those advantages that come from Edge of Extinction are going to be more expensive.
Jeremy's going to owe everybody on his tribe a fire token and have five advantages.
That's true.
Hey, that can I borrow a fire token for what? I just need it. Don't worry about it. I'll get you later.
I'll tell you about it at the finale.
Jeremy does have a big leg up in terms of the understanding everything, and then also having Natalie on the edge. Let me ask you a question from John David Roach, who wants to know, how strange was it to learn about how the edge played out? If I remember correctly, Chris and Rick were two of the boots that you saw before you left. And as a follow up, who is the eliminated currently that Jamal thinks is the best shot to return to the at the end and underwooding it to win this thing? So can you just talk a little bit about what was your how did you learn about season 38?
All right. So funny story. The Wednesday that we got out to L.A., the day before we flew out to Fiji, was actually episode 4 or 5. I'm not sure exactly the number. And so we saw Rick Devins go home.
Yeah. I think that was 4.
And so they were supposed to take our phones away the night that we got there.
Yeah.
And so when they came to take my phone, I was like, hey, I'm actually watching Survivor right now. Could you not take my phone? And they were like, okay, I don't know if that's against the rules or not. I got to go check with so-and-so. And they just never came back to take my phone. So I actually had my phone through the night into the Thursday. So I got to watch the full episode. So I thought that was funny. I had a little leg up over some of the other survivors on season 39 who hadn't seen that episode of Edge of Extinction. But anyway, so when we got back, we had some catching up to do because we missed 6 weeks essentially of Edge of Extinction, and it was fascinating, absolutely fascinating to see how it played out. I was very surprised. I was disappointed along with everyone else, right? I didn't think it was necessarily the way it went, especially coming fresh off of our season. We were like, well, what the heck, man? Like, if there was Edge for us, like, we could have all had a chance to come back in the game. So I wasn't as much of a fan of the way it played out when I was watching the show.
Yeah.
What was the second part of his question?
Who do you think has the shot to return and beat the Chris three? Underwood of these three so far?
I mean, it is not even a contest right now. Like, Natalie Anderson has to be the absolute favorite to come back into the game. She's focused, she's smart, she's calm, cool, collected. She's a physical dominant beast, and she's angry. So I think she definitely has the best chance of coming back in the game.
Okay. This is a question from Tommy Guam, who wants to know, would Jamal have called out Jeff Probst for his British accent to open up the season? Of course, we all remember Jeff's big toast to kick off the season. Here it is one more time.
To Survivor, because a drink before war is always a good idea.
Would you have given Jeff any feedback on that?
How have we figured it out yet? I know we were trying to track
it down.
Yeah. So no. So no one anywhere has ever linked this phrase or this style.
The best we have is that maybe this is something Mark Burnett says.
I don't think that's true. It has to be that Jeff just got off of rewatching Game of Thrones or something and just thought that was a cool thing to say. What was he doing? There's nothing that explains that. Would I have given him a hard time about that? Of course not. He's Jeff Probst. I would have joined in, obviously. I would have been like, yes, Jeff, you are correct. Drink before war, yes. Obviously.
Jamal, what do we say before we drink?
We obviously say drinks before war are a good idea. Why not?
Why did Jeff call on you a couple of times during the season? Did he just strike you as you were the big fan in the group?
No, I just was doing it, right? So the first tribal council that I went to, I was amped, and all of us were, all the Jeff-isms that we experienced during the game, the first time we experienced them was a very exciting moment. I remember being in the waiting line before we go into a challenge, and we're standing there, and it's all feeling very background, right? It's all feeling very production, because we're intense and we're putting sunscreen on and we're getting mic'd up, and they're telling us what our wardrobe is going to be, and it's very much okay, we're not really playing Survivor right now, we're just kind of getting ready for the show. So we're standing there in line with our sign and everything, and we hear it. We hear Jeff go, come on in, guys. And all of us were like, oh, we did it. It's real. It's happening. This is amazing. So we were all very excited to start to hear and collect all the Jeffisms during our season. So when I walked into my first tribal and he starts to do the thing, fire represents your life and your fire's up. And I'm just mouthing it. I'm mouthing it along with him. And he must have just saw me doing it. And he just was like, go ahead, Jamal, go ahead. And I was like, well, when your fire's out, so are you. And so that's how that went down. So yeah, me and Jeff had a little connection. We were vibing out there.
You had a bond.
Yeah, we had a bond for sure.
Okay. Baby Andy wants to know, what was your conversation like with Rob and Sandra on the Island of the Idols? Did your impression about either of them change after talking with them?
I am so sad for Survivor Universe to not have gotten the opportunity to see more of my interaction with Rob and Sandra. It was so fun. It was so animated and exciting and just very Survivor-y, right? So I got into a lot of stuff with Rob and Sandra about their seasons and what they did. And we were talking all these strategies about how to use this blank parchment. And it just was a really cool conversation. And I was so excited for everyone to see it. So I was really sad when you didn't get to see any of it, really. But the conversation was really lively. It was really fun. I just wish that you would have seen it. What was that? What was the specifics of that question again?
He wanted your impression of either of them change.
My impression of them change. Yeah. No. Right. I was starstruck. My reaction to them was completely genuine because no one told me that Rob and Sandra were there. So when I saw them, it was actually me seeing them and not knowing that they were there.
Yeah.
And realizing that for the first time. And so then I just was kind of in that mode of oh my God, I'm sitting next to Rob and Sandra. This is amazing. And then when Rob goes, you've lost your vote, or I'm reading the note and it says, you lost your vote. I kind of look at them and I'm like, oh, right. Mm-hmm. You guys are villains. You you guys aren't on my side here. Like, you're not here to help me.
Yeah.
Like, you're here to destroy me. Mm-hmm. And so there's actually a cool clip of you seeing me give Rob the side eye while mm-hmm. I'm reading and recognizing what it says. And I kind of look at Rob and I'm like, oh, you dirty dog. You, like, I can't believe you screwed me over like this. But I, you know, whatever, right? Like, I had a very good time out there, mm-hmm. and Rob and Sandra are awesome. And me and Sandra bonded because we're both Puerto Rican. And so we just bonded over life. And so I think they're great. It was fun. I just hated that my time with them was just so, so truncated in terms of the airing, and that it just was so detrimental to my game.
Yeah.
I wish it actually helped me, because then I could think more positively about it.
Yeah. Well, Scott Chernoff, the great Scott Chernoff, has a question about if the survivors see a clue dangling from a tree, should they think twice? What are the implications of Jamal's experience with that dangling clue that screwed him so unfairly? And it really was very unfair that nobody ever has gotten like the exploding idol. We've never seen anybody, you know, find an idol. And it's like, you know, when somebody robs a bank and the paint explodes and it's like, you got actually, that's a good idea for a twist of, you know, you found the paint exploding paint idol. And now everybody knows you were looking for an idol. But no, it has never happened. It's not a thing, Jamal.
No, it's not. It's not. And, you know, my evolution of my thoughts about this has been interesting, because at first I was like, whatever, you know, it was a cool idea. Like, I got to execute this really interesting idea with the legacy advantage and all. But when, as I started watching what other people's Island of the Idols experiences were, that's when I started getting mad, because I was
the
like,
only one that got zonked.
I could have flipped a coin and got the most incredible power ever. Like, mm-hmm. I could have just like crawled into the other camp and gotten an idol. Like, what is going on? Like, why was mine so horrendous? So in terms of the impact of the game, I actually think that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because you're right. There was no element of Survivor for 39 seasons where finding a clue in the landscape that you're in the camp is a bad thing, right? That's not a thing. They made it a thing by doing that to me. So I guarantee you, if they ever hang a clue again in the next few seasons, that's exactly what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Is someone is going to second guess it. So they kind of like created this element of the game by somehow insisting that I should have known.
Yeah.
And so now you have to be weary. I mean, the only thing that comes close is this idea of like finding a fake idol, right? Mm-hmm. So like, if you find an idol and it was maybe too easy to find or too obvious or whatever, then maybe you're suspicious that like, oh, it's a fake idol. But other than that, from production to have a note that's written in the Survivor font that says, "Take me, I'm yours." Like, come on, mm-hmm. that doesn't make sense.
Right. Jamal, I think that if anything, that, you know, and maybe it could have been a cool idea. Maybe if there was like, you know, that's what it says, take me, I'm yours. But then like, if you look like 10 feet up, it's like, do not pull this rope. Like, there's like something like, well, you should have been more observant. It clearly says, don't take this. This is a trick. And if you were looking, then you would have seen it. And then we would have seen like who walked past it, who would have potentially, you know, seen that there was some tip off that it was a trick. But there was nothing based on what we saw. And so, didn't, you know.
Or if the note said something like, you know, you have a choice to make, you know, this could be bad or this could be good, you know, assess the place in the game that you are and make a decision about whether or not it's worth it. Right. Yeah. Like
pull
some
at your
some
own
kind
risk.
Of, yeah. Pull at your own risk. Yeah. Something that kind of insinuated that there was a nefarious result to this, grabbing the clue, right? So Dean, for example, got the chance to flip a coin and it could either lose his vote or he could get the idol nullifier. Great, right? He had the opportunity to think about it, make a choice, and he made his choice. I wish I had a choice to make. I just didn't have the opportunity to make a choice.
Yeah. Okay. All right. We didn't like that one. Ron from Toronto wants to know, who do you think is going to go further in this season, Rob or Sandra?
Ron, great question. Rob or Sandra? You know, based on the way that they play, I think Sandra has the better opportunity to go further. I think Rob just can't, he has no other option but to play the, you know, tribe leader, godfather, as Adam says. He has to show up. Like, he just does. Like, if Rob attempts to play a low key game, the game is going to get away from him and people are going to conspire against him just based on his previous reputation. Whereas Sandra gets the opportunity to play this like reckless behind the scenes game of just kind of pointing the finger at everyone else. You know, she sits out of challenges. She's not a threat in individual immunities. And I think people just feel like they can take her a little further and a little further and a little further. And that's how she wins the game. So I think Sandra has the better chance of the two.
Caitlin Schmidt wants to know, are you still rooming with Jack? And if so, how is that going? Do you have any fun stories you could tell?
Oh, Caitlin, great question. So no, unfortunately, Jack left me. Jack found better pastures. His heart, he followed his heart, and he is now in a very loving relationship with one Elizabeth Beisel, who we all know and love. Jack rooming with Jack was awesome. So we kept it on the low. Obviously, we were rooming in the entirety of our season airing. And so we had a bunch of watch parties together with our collective friends. And he would take care of the dog when I was gone, and we would meet up and just kind of have late night talks. So no funny stories, but just a true representation of what my relationship was like with him. And it all started, as you saw, like Jack is awesome. And so we really got the chance to explore our friendship, in a really, really deep, concrete way, as roommates. So you know, I'm sad about it, but he's not too far. He's an hour south of me, so I can go visit the two of them, whenever I want.
He's a good roommate, Jack.
He's a good roommate. One of the stipulations to his rooming with me, was that he had to keep the sink clear of dirty dishes.
Yes.
And he executed that task to perfection. So for that, I am thankful. My dishes are currently piled up in the sink, so I'm missing his presence greatly.
So wait, he had to do all the dishes? That was one of the stipulations?
I didn't wash a single dish during the time that he was my roommate, which I thought was a pretty good deal because, you know, he got a living situation near his lady love.
His boo.
And all he had to do was wash my dirty dishes. So
all right. Speaking of love interests, when you talked with Josh Wigler in the first one out, you talked about Survivor. You had a unique experience with Survivor. Survivor was a show when you were in a relationship that would be a date night show, and you would end up watching a lot of Survivor when you were dating. And then if you were single, you wouldn't end up watching the show. Do I have that correct?
Yeah. I mean, it's not as cut and dry. I think it just kind of ebbed and flowed, such that Survivor ended up being a big part of my relationships, over the years, which is really funny. So that's kind of my relationship to Survivor, blossomed within my relationships with people over the years since the early 2000s.
Did you ever date anybody that's like, what is this? What are we doing? Why are we watching this?
No, that's the funny thing, is that everyone wasn't an enthusiast. Actually, most recently, I got pulled back into the show by the person that I was dating. And I credit her with me even being on the show, because my whole origin story with Survivor was that my girlfriend at the time and her friend had heard about an open casting call at Mohegan Sun, a casino here in Connecticut, or the next state over in Connecticut. And I hadn't heard about it. I just was kind of just watching the show weekly, but they were really, really into it. So they were like, "Hey, Jamal, like, come with us." It was a Friday afternoon, so I would have had to take work off. So I played a little hooky from work and went and tried out for Survivor back for season 35. And that was the beginning of everything. So I credit her and my relationship and her relationship to Survivor for where I am now, having been a contestant on season 39.
So
it's pretty wild.
You talked about how that you were in the mix for Heroes versus Healers versus the other thing, and then you didn't get on that show. Did you have to apply again, or did you just hear from casting about, hey, or that we're, you know, that we remember you and we would, you know, we want to bring you back into the mix?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm sure casting is going to hate that I'm telling this story, but after making it as far as you could make it for season 35, literally did all the things, made it all the way through finals, met Jeff Probst, met Matt, met all the casting producers, like everybody, did all the medical tests and everything, literally waiting for a phone call to get on a plane to do season 35. They called me and they said, "You didn't make it. So sorry." So really devastating. Really, I was really angry about it. Like, I was like, oh man, like, you strung me along. I had to take a week off of work to go out to finals, right? Mm-hmm. So I kind of was a little bit bitter. But going through that experience got me so excited, right? I was thinking about all the possibilities and what it would be like to come and do the show. So for the next 2 years, I emailed casting like once every 2 or 3 months. Mm-hmm. Just very polite. I just was like, hey, still here.
Right.
Here's the update on my life. Here's what's going on. Here's some commentary on the current season of Survivor. So I was telling them my thoughts.
You gave them feedback.
Yeah, I gave them some feedback. Not really feedback. I just was like telling them what I would have done, right? So there were some things that happened on Ghost Island and some things that happened on Heroes, Hustlers, and the other thing that I was like, oh, I was out there, I would have done this and that. And, you know, just consider me, you know, keep me in the Rolodex. And then I actually sent my last email. I literally wrote my last email about 6 months before they called me. And I said, okay, I get it. You know, I'm not going to be the clingy ex-boyfriend, who keeps harassing you. Mm-hmm. I just want you to know, thank you so much for the opportunity. And here's some last updates, and, you know, feel free to reach out. And then I hadn't heard from them forever. And then my casting director, 6 months later, out of nowhere, called me while I was Uber driving, because I drive for Uber and Lyft.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Luckily I didn't have a passenger at the time. But my phone rang, I pulled over, and it was my casting director. And it was so incredible to hear from her. Mm-hmm. She literally said, hey, you know, we're interested in you. Are you still interested in doing this? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. And she said, we'll make a quick video, you know, do another casting video and send it so that we can keep you in the mix, whatever. I literally did my video right then and there. So my casting video for season 39 is me in my car freaking out that I had just got a call from Survivor.
Yeah.
To do season 39. So that's how that all went down.
Yeah. Did they tell you with season 35, was it that they couldn't fit you into one of the H's? Was that, or they don't even get into that?
Yeah. Well, so I found out during the casting process for 39 that for 35, the issue really was that I just kind of botched the last interview. And the last interview was the one in front of the executives. It was like all the CBS people, the top people. And what happened was, they were so excited about me that they wanted to put me last in my casting group, because they were like, we're just going to like knock this out of the park with the home run with our last person because we like him so much. He's a shoe-in. He's definitely going to, show up and do really well. And I just was drained. Like, the casting process is gruesome, right? Mm-hmm. So you're there for 5 days locked in a hotel room. You can't talk to anybody. You know the story. And so when I was last, I just was so low energy and just kind of intimidated also by this experience that I just let the energy leave the room. I didn't knock it out the park. And at that point, they had already had, you know, a group that they would have to have taken somebody out in order to put me in. And they just weren't at the place to do that.
Yeah.
So that was my downfall. But knowing that, it made me really show up for season 39. So my advice to anybody who's in the process for Survivor, you have to kill it at every single stage of the process. So
sure,
don't let yourself get lulled into boredom or sleep or low energy. You have to bring it the whole time through.
And Jamal, I never thought about the order of which you go in as being important. Like, I thought like off the top of my head, I would say, like, oh, you probably want to go early in the day because, you know, I listened to an audio book a year or two ago and they talked about how, you know, if you are going to have surgery, you want to be, you know, going earlier in the day, or if you have like a parole hearing, you want to be in the earlier part of the day because that you have by the end of the day, people are tired and like make mistakes. Right. But so in casting, you want to be last, I guess, that they wanted to be like, sort of like they want to close with their, you know, big number.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, right? That wouldn't have been my choice, right? My mm-hmm. choice would have been to go early so that I could be,
a morning person,
fresh, ready to go. But it's the casting group that is interested in impressing their bosses, mm-hmm. right? So they want to show their bosses, who are the ones that might be getting tired and might be like getting at the end of their rope, that, you know, hey, look, we have this home run hit that we went and got to show you
the main event.
The main event, yeah, and I didn't close it for them, so I'm so grateful that they recognized that and were able to bring me back, which is funny because then I literally was first,
yeah,
in my season 39 casting, because they were like, let's not make that same mistake,
and it worked. Jamal, do you have any good stories about driving the Uber and the Lyft? That's the thing that I'm really fascinated by, driving the car. I feel like that because basically, like at some point when this whole podcast thing, fades out, I'm trying to think about what I'm going to do next. And I feel like that's really high up on the, potential opportunities for me.
You're going to be an Uber driver? That's amazing.
I mean, not qualified at this point to do anything else, and I feel like that I think I would enjoy the conversation.
You would. You absolutely would. So actually, let me dial that back for a second. So here's a funny thing. So I've been Uber driving for about 4 years, maybe 4 or 5 years, mm-hmm. and even then started, it was like late in the game because Uber had been around for a while and Providence was a little late to the party. Mm-hmm. Uber kind of a thing in other cities. But what I've noticed though is Uber and Lyft and all of that has become so ingrained in the culture now that it's not anything that anyone flinches at anymore. Right. When I first started, it was still kind of a weird thing, right? It was still kind of a weird thing to get into a stranger's car on the side of the road. Mm-hmm. So you kind of felt the need to be like, oh, hi, how are you doing? Like, my name is so-and-so. Like, I'm going here. Like, how long have you been driving Uber? Like, interesting. What's your backstory? How many kids do you have? Right. Like you felt the like urge to do the small talk with this random person. But now it just has ingrained itself into such a service mm-hmm. that people are much less willing to engage.
Well, that's why I thought that I could listen to podcasts. Then I feel like that's the, the other side of it.
By that, you have to be careful because some people don't like to have the noise in the car.
No, but I would. So I think what I would do is I'd do the left earbud and then I thought about this a lot, Jamal.
It's a good thought.
Yeah,
I definitely listened to you while Uber driving.
You'll get a 1-star review if you don't have the earbuds in.
Yeah. But actually, yeah, quick fun story. The one that I actually told in my original casting video for season 35 is I'm convinced, I have no doubt about this, that I was a getaway car for some kind of unsavory behavior that took place.
Yes.
Because I was showing up at a house, right? And as I was approaching the house, there were cop cars everywhere with their lights on and their flashlights and everything. So as I drove by, they were like looking in my car with their flashlights. And when I was approaching the car, my phone rang. You know, you can call the Uber driver if you call it. So my phone rang and I was like, oh, hello. And they said, oh, are you the Uber driver? I was like, yeah. If you could come the next block over, that'd be great, because that's where we are actually. Like, we're not at the house that we said we were. Yeah. If you could just come over one block. And I was like, okay, yeah, no problem. Turned around, went back by the cops. They looked in my car all suspicious. Like, what's this car doing? I go into the next block over, and out of the bushes come 4 kids, like teenagers, running into my car. They open the door, they jump in, and they're like, go, 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 go as fast as you can. And they were like, just drive right by the cops. Like, if they ask you to stop, like, don't stop for them. Just keep going.
Stop.
And I was like, okay, I clearly am not going to do that because I am not going to be an accomplice to whatever
this is.
But I'm going to drive because you called me to drive. So I'm driving by and the same thing, cops look at my window, they flash, whatever, whatever. And I keep going. They don't stop me. And so then once we're gone, the kids are like, oh, thank goodness we got away with it. Great, great, great. And I was like, I'm not asking any questions. I'm just going to get my fare and get out of here. Mm-hmm. So that was my most like harrowing Uber driver experience where I thought I was an accomplice to a crime at some point.
Wow.
Very funny. Yeah.
Yeah. That's wild.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, it gets rough out here in these Providence streets.
Did the kids give you a 5-star review after?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. They probably didn't. Mm. Just because, you know, they're kids.
Yeah.
But I deserved it. That's for sure.
Mike Edwards wants to know, are there any king, queen, and jack combos on Winners at War so far? That got a lot of mileage for an episode. The king, the queen, and the jack.
The bane of my existence.
Yeah. I think I see one.
You see a king, queen, and jack experience out there right now?
Not as literal as the king and the queen and the jack.
A Denise Adam Ben situation?
No, I'm thinking of Boston Rob, Parvati, and Ethan.
Ethan, okay. Yeah. I think that's probably the closest to that construction for sure.
Yeah. Plus, you know, they already have the poker connection with Boston Rob.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's exactly what it could be. Fortunately for them, I don't think that's how it's going to be packaged. Because they don't have someone as creative as a Nora Salmon on their team.
Yeah, that was Nora. Because I think Lauren said it also in the episode, but you Nora know, gets the credit.
It was all Nora. Okay. It was all Nora, dude. And it's so frustrating to me because, like I have said for months, it wasn't a thing. Mm. You know what? I felt such a kinship with Kim. Yeah. Stradlin during her tribal, where she was like, look, guys, it's not a thing. The Poker Alliance is not a thing. Okay. Like, stop saying Poker Alliance because it's not a thing. That's exactly how I feel right now because people are like, oh, yeah, you had the King, Queen, Jack. Like, you guys were a trio, blah, blah, blah. And all of us, all three of us are like, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. Definitely was not a thing. You know, I had a close alliance with Molly. Jack actually felt closer to Tommy at that point in the game. Like, we just were three people who had like similar personalities maybe or similar vibes. And Nora being on the outs didn't have a finger on the pulse of what was going on in the game. And so she just kind of concocted this whole thing because Jack's name is Jack. And she had some feelings towards Molly
right
about how she conducted herself, and so she just came up with King, Queen, Jack, and that just stuck. Mm-hmm. But that goes to show, right? Like, and I think everyone has talked about this since, is you're just looking for something.
Anything.
Just whatever thing that is, whoever leaves the camp, whoever takes the clothes and spreads them out on the beach, like whatever that thing is, to get the majority of that first vote together is what people will use. So you just have to be so careful about anything that divides you from the majority.
Okay. Joshua Aaron Harkness says, do you think that we will see the blank piece of paper advantage this season, and how many fire tokens should it cost?
You will never see that again, ever, ever. Because, and here's why I know this, because the way that they edited it, mm-hmm. that's too many edits, but the way that they edited it was an indication to me that even Survivor knew
they felt like it was a dud.
I think they knew it was a dud. And I think if I didn't do what I did with it and make it such a lasting element of the game all the way through to the finale, I think they would have done everything they could to sweep it under the rug. But they just couldn't because it became such a thing.
It was a thing.
I think they were like, this was silly. We shouldn't have done this.
Jamal, we never got to get your reaction on what was your reaction to when you learned that Dean had made a fake legacy advantage.
Yeah. That's so funny. You're right. I learned it at the finale, at the final tribal. I had no idea. So I know there was a lot of like talk about, oh, well, you know, Jamal might have seen that it wasn't his handwriting or something. Like, literally had no idea. So when Dean played it when there were nine people left, or played his fake of a fake at nine people left, I honestly thought that that was my legacy advantage. So I was like, okay, great. Like, that's it. It's over. Mm-hmm. I did a thing. It was cool to see it kind of play out. And Jeff said it was fake, and now that's gone. I think there's something about my personality or the way that I react to things. Like, I'm not super emotional in my reaction, right? So I didn't do a big like laugh or yeah. or
actually
big,
I have that clip. Can I play? I think I have the clip yeah. of when that you were asked about the legacy advantage at the final trial.
So 9 and 6, I was safe right here. This is real. Jamal, is it?
That is not real, Dean.
So I went to Island of the Idols, and given to me was a blank piece of parchment with a pencil. And it was up to me to decide how I wanted to use that in any way I wanted to use it.
Cool.
So it has no power in the game. But this is actually pretty awesome. What Dean is doing is he's saying he didn't even need to use it.
Right.
And he's showing it to us as though it could have been real.
Right.
And that's pretty awesome.
Exactly.
But
yeah,
I got to tell you this in person, I believe, but I don't know if I get to talk about it on the podcast, but I just thought that it spoke to me your kindness in that you could have gotten up in that and you know, in your face, you idiot, you that's fake, mm-hmm. you moron. But you did not do that. You actually gave him credit for it, and you didn't make it about you. And I just thought that was, an incredibly, kind gesture on your part in that moment. I think that very few Survivor players would have afforded somebody in Dean's position that kind of kindness.
That's nice of you to say. I appreciate that. I do disagree with you, though, because I think there's something about the position of a juror, right, that puts you in the mindset of, let me try to imagine myself voting for each one of these people. And maybe that's not for everybody. I'm sure there are some bitter juries out there. But I definitely took on this role of like, okay, these people are pitching their case to me. What do I need to do to feel good about each of them in my own mind if I were to cast a vote towards them? And honestly, it was impressive. Like, it literally was an amazing move. And I wish so much that we had seen a final six play out to kind of just see this thing all the way through.
Yeah.
But man, like, really, really impressive, like really clever, right? You think mm-hmm. this thing is real. You know, everybody knows that you have it. If you think it's real and everyone knows you have it, let's fake out everybody. Make them think I've played it, and now I can hold on to the real one. Mm-hmm. Like, what? That is ingenious. And I will give Dean credit for that for as long as we live, because that really was an impressive move.
Yeah.
And I wanted people to understand that from his perspective, that is exactly what he should have done with it. And that was cool.
Yeah. Well, I really think that you are one of the few exceptions. And I think that speaks to, your thoughtfulness and, what we've come to know about you since, you first appeared on our TV screens, a couple, 6 months ago. But I think that the way that you think things through and, have empathy for how other people might be feeling in these situations, I think is, speaks a lot about you as, a person and a character that we've come to know.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you to say. I think where that comes from, though, is like a deep yearning for the truth, mm-hmm. And I think all too often, especially fans of Survivor, kind of settle for what's fed to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think where that comes from is like, no, I want to actually know like why someone made that decision and where that could have been inspired from. And in general, right? Like if you have two people sitting across from each other, right, at a table, and you have this board in between them, and you kind of spin it around, and you spin around a side that has a red color, right? And the other side has a blue color, right? And then you spin it around one time. So now I'm seeing the blue, and you ask me, what does the other person see? The ability to say like, no, that person sees red, right? I see blue, but that person sees red. I think that's a really key step right? To empathy. It's a key step to understanding the way the world works, right? Like other people see red when I see blue. Like that is the way into each other's hearts, right? And into each other's experience in a way that will just make the world a better place and help us make better decisions in the way we interact with each other. So
yeah,
that's where that comes from.
Yeah. But I just also, I think that just to go back to the scene that you had with Jack with the do-rag, that, you know, you could have jumped all over him and just, you know, completely, you know, blew him up and nobody would have begrudged you that for doing that. But just the, you know, the kindness and sort of like the, you know, wanting to, you know, have a conversation with him and, you know, the empathy that you showed towards him in that moment, you know, that was also just, you know, really remarkable. And I feel like that we have, you know, so little of that in the world right now. And that's the, you know, that's something that just really impressed me about you as well. Just, you know, on this same, you know, subject matter.
Yeah. That's sweet, Rob. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, no, I mean, with that whole situation, right. I mean, I'll say it 1,000 times. Jack is amazing. And Jack really contributed as much as I did to the way to allowing for that interaction to go as well as it did. And the key to it, right, was prioritizing the relationship, right? Like that has to be at the core of any interaction like that, right? Like I don't gain anything out of blowing up, out of calling him out, out of like set $1 million aside, set, you know, getting further in the game aside. If I have a friend that I want to continue a relationship with, it is imperative, right, that they understand more about me and I understand more about them. Mm-hmm. And so what do we gain by jumping down each other's throats and making people feel guilty and bad for, you know, honest mistakes that they might make? And it just gave us both that opportunity to prioritize the relationship and learn. I learned as much about him as he learned about me in that interaction. And that's what allowed us to grow even closer together.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I, you know, not to be on like my soapbox, but I just feel like that the biggest problems that we have is that it's the world has made it so easy to be able to have like these like drive by snap judgments of anybody that, you know, that we just online, that you can just say whatever you want to anybody online. And I feel like that it's that we have so few conversations with people that we may not, you know, completely agree with, that makes it, you know, so much harder and, you know, makes there be, you know, so much more distance between all of us, even though we're more and more connected than we've ever been.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that. And what continues to be what is adds to the challenge is people, you don't know what you're competing against. Right. So here's actually a really good example with our recent conversation about politics. I won't make it completely political, but, you know, I came out and I in support of Pete Buttigieg and I expressed as much. And someone didn't like that and expressed as much to me, and which is fine. I'm all for like really constructive political debate. But he went really hard with it. And he said, like, well, you're a sellout. I'm so embarrassed to that you did this. Like, how could you? Blah, blah. And I just was like, wow, like one, you know nothing about me, right? And you feel very, very comfortable calling me all kinds of names and making assumptions about my character. So I must be competing with some version of what you think it means to be a Pete Buttigieg supporter or maybe a not Bernie Sanders supporter that has nothing to do with me, right? It has nothing to do with me. And I think to be able to keep that as an arm's length actually allows me some insight and some empathy for him, right? To be like, oh man, like you have some stuff going on for you that has nothing to do with me. And so I can actually extend some goodwill to you and give you room to kind of work through that without taking it personal. I think there definitely needs to be more of that for sure.
Okay. To make it on a little bit of a lighter note, John Tinkham wants to know, Jamal.
Wait, what's his name?
John Tinkham.
John. Excellent.
Wants to know, would you be interested in discussing season 3, episode 7 of Family Matters if it ever comes up on Rob and Akiva Need a Podcast? Now, I didn't know why.
I need some background to this.
What's coming up? Okay. All right. So I do a podcast. I don't only just talk about Survivor, Jamal. I do some other podcasts, including one where I spin a wheel of podcast ideas, and we have a fishbowl full of ping pong balls. Sometimes we're a few ping pong balls short of the fishbowl of different shows that we talk about a season 3, episode 7 of. And Family Matters is on there. Now, apparently, so that's in the fishbowl. Apparently, that I must have talked about something with the birthday boy, Bryce Isaiah, the birthday baby boy, Bryce Isaiah, which caused you on September 17th. Yes. On September 17th, 2019, to send this video. Come on, man. You don't know the theme to Family Matters? I got your Stefan Urkel right here.
Right.
Reading the good news on a newspaper page. Love and condition of a grand design. Some people say it's even harder to find. Well, there must be some magic clue inside this gentle
words.
Is all I see is a tower of dreams. Real love bursting out of every seed. Days go by. It's the day of the love of the family. But think it
That is it.
That was wonderful getting to hear you harmonize with yourself.
Oh man, Family Matters is such a cornerstone to my childhood. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't remember. I vaguely remember something must have come up with with Family
Bryce
Matters.
Isaiah decided to clown me, or think he was clowning me, by calling me Steve Urkel from my picture. And so he was trying to, he gave it a good effort. He was like, oh, he looks like Steve Urkel. Ha, you know, Family Matters, blah, blah, blah. And he tried to sing the theme song and he couldn't do it.
Why did he say he looked like Steve Urkel?
Well, because Bryce is a jerk. That's why.
But no, Bryce, I love him. I don't know. Did you have suspenders in your picture? Where was he getting Urkel from?
He was getting a little Stephen Urkel vibe because from the, you know, by the way I talk or the way I look. Look, it's not the first time, Bryce. Yeah. Okay, not the first time someone's compared me to Stephen Urkel or Carlton from Fresh Prince. I get it. I understand. A nerdy black guy has to just be one of these tropes. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to try to clown me, know the theme song. So I had to that quick. That's all.
Okay. All right. So should they reboot Family Matters? That, you know, they did it with Fuller House.
Fuller House. Yeah. They should not.
They should leave it alone.
Leave it alone.
Carl Winslow and everybody alone.
Yeah. No, I Jaleel White has been very vocal about how he's like trying to shake his Stephen Urkel character. He just is so good at it. That's why.
Yeah, if it hasn't happened by now,
Jaleel White do his thing. He's a bona fide actor and producer, and he's doing great.
Okay. All right. Jeff McGinnis wants to know, to your knowledge, did anyone learn anything useful at the Island of the Idols?
Oh man, to my knowledge, did anyone learn anything useful at Island of the Idols? I would have to say no. I mean, right? No, because first of all, the winner of Island of the Idols didn't go to Island of the Idols, didn't have an idol, didn't use an idol, didn't know where idols were, didn't have an advantage, just played a pure, beautiful survivor social game. Mm-hmm. So Island of the Idols was just a big old gimmick that didn't quite pan out the way that maybe the producers thought it would. So I have to say just a big hard no. In fact, for me and probably some others, it hindered their game. It got in the way. You know, what could have happened if I didn't go to Island of the Idols at that moment, or if Vince didn't go to Island of the Idols when he went, or if Nora ended up lasting, but she had a really tough return from Island of the Idols, as you recall. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it played with the game in ways that was more detrimental to people's games than helpful, clearly.
Okay. I want to ask you one other question from Twitter. I always like to, you know, look at what the guests are talking about on social media and see. I want to ask you about the oily tortellini.
Yeah. Go for it.
You tweeted on February 13th. Question for the masses. What is it about oily tortellini that white people love so much? I see this stuff at every single conference and catered lunch I've ever been to. Hashtag confused. Hashtag research.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to learn. It's you know what I'm talking about, Rob.
I know what you're talking about. To be fair, that I'm not a fan. I don't really like it. You know, I prefer my pasta, as Boston Rob would have, or my macaroni, as Boston Rob would have us say, with more of a red sauce. I'm not a big fan of the pasta salads. I do see them sometimes, but I'm not an oily tortellini guy.
It's amazing. I don't know what this dish is called or why it has like worked its way into the culture such that when you amass, 50 or more people in a room, this seems to be the go-to dish. Mm-hmm. I don't get it.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
I mean, if I had to guess, I think it looks kind of classy, multicolored tortellini. I think it doesn't need to stay hot. So it's not like that, if any, you just leave it and have it sit out. Like it's a potato salad, or like, some other like coleslaw, unless Aubrey is going to be there, isn't really a crowd pleaser. So I think it looks kind of fancy and I think you can just sort of like leave it out all day.
But what doesn't make any sense to me is nobody comes back from these experiences raving about the cold, oily tortellini that was at the lunch. one of my jobs when I was working at schools was to host, new student events. And one event that I hosted was for new students of color, like new families of color to, to the schools that I was working at. And I ordered this incredible spread from this local soul food spot. We had all kinds of deliciousness that you can imagine from this place. And the talk about this event for a whole year was how good the food was. Mm-hmm. Like, don't you want that to be the case? Like, why are you ordering oily cold tortellini? Nobody loves it. Mm-hmm. Nobody is talking about it. I just don't understand. So I think we need to do better a society.
So let's go down with the cold, oily tortellini.
I want to destroy that industry single-handedly.
All right. If people see it at functions, I want them to tweet a picture to you so we can raise awareness that this stuff is out there.
I will retweet it. I promise you. Let's get some awareness up. Okay.
Can we get a hashtag for the down with the tortellini movement?
Yeah, I also spelled it wrong. I learned in my tweet, so I don't know that tortellini should be in the tweet in the hashtag. You have a bunch of people misspelling.
Okay, all right. So we'll come up with something like that to get rid of it. Yeah. You look like you're so disgusted with the tortellini. I'm
really,
in the picture.
Really grossed out. Yeah, like really perturbed by this experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and then Felipe Shimon, I'll give Felipe the last word. Jamal, you did a great job on the Island of the Idols, both teaching people about important issues, but also being taught, listening, and growing from discussions of important issues. So does Jamal have any wisdom to impart on the audience and open healthy discussions with empathy, sympathy, and respect? Not really a survivor question, but I love Jamal's human compassion, and he's an eloquent speaker. And then Felipe added a missed opportunity to use the word bequeath in his question. did you want to use this platform, Jamal, to just take one more shot at the tortellini?
No, I'm all done with
you
the tortellini.
You don't seem to have compassion for the tortellini.
I don't. You're right. I don't have compassion for tortellini. That's my limitation. I'll be the first one to recognize my flaws as a human being. I'm not perfect. I have no compassion or sympathy for oily tortellini. Yeah, that's true.
Jamal, what if you went to a fundraiser for Mayor Pete and then Mayor Pete had the oily tortellini on the spread? Would you consider rescinding your support for Mayor Pete?
No. I would immediately ask him for a job on his campaign, and my first reform.
Oh, you would get people talking about the food at the fundraiser.
Yeah, That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. I would get tweets. I would get commentary, and yes, we'd build this ground movement.
You would use the crisis as an opportunity.
That's it. That's the way to go. That's what I'm talking about. But I appreciate Felipe's question, and this sentiment has been really touching. Since the season aired, I just have been really, really floored by the level of the ways that people are really connecting with my story, you mm-hmm. know, and the things that came up for me, the stories that people have told me have been really moving and touching, like experiences that they've had with discrimination or issues of their own identities, and just seeing in me someone that they wanted to be close to in life and have people like that in their own lives. Like that's beautiful, man. So the foundation of it, right, is just, you know, finding ways to prioritize the relationship and whatever conflicts are arising in your life. And also the bigger key is to recognize your own power, right? Recognize your own privilege and interactions and making sure you're also doing the work that you'd ask of other people, right? Recognize your privilege, right? Like I am a man. Right? I do not know what it's like to be a woman. I do not know what it's like to have the fears and concerns that women have just because they're women. I work every day to get a better understanding of that and to make sure I'm not part of the problem in most circumstances. Mm-hmm. So that's what I would impart and say is to prioritize relationships and recognize your own privilege.
Yes. I recently had a reminder about mine on another podcast, but that's a story for another day, Jamal.
Okay. Hey, we're all growing. We're all growing. And you're still a good person, Thank Rob. You. I don't know the details.
I try.
You're still a good
I yeah, try.
Absolutely.
All right, Jamal, if people want to, you know, keep up with what you're doing, to send you pictures of oily tortellini at catered lunches, where should they go?
Yes, absolutely. So Twitter, JamManK9. I tweeted back at you to explain what my Twitter handle is.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, you're a dog lover. And you were worried your dog was going to potentially interrupt us. And your dog was very well behaved. What kind of dog do you have?
He's a black lab mix. Mm-hmm. He's all over my Instagram, so you can know what he looks like. My Instagram is JamManK91 because my JamManK9 handle was hacked, so I needed to get a new one.
Oh no!
But the big news is that the incredible, impressive, amazing woman that is Janet Carbon,
yes,
and I are teaming up. We're actually going to be working together in the years to come, hopefully, in doing a kind of duo where we do like a little speaking tour.
Oh, nice.
And work with students and groups and adults and camps and all kinds of people to put on a program called Keeping Your Fire Alive. And we're in the starting phases of that. We're doing our pilot program at the end of April. And if it goes well, we'll have all kinds of promotional material and try to get this off the ground. So Janet and I are teaming up to try to make the world a better place one session at a time. So if you're interested, my email, survivorjamal@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. And
that was your email from before you got on the show?
Definitely not. Definitely not.
When you said that to me, I was like, oh, that's smart. You should have like a separate email just for survivor stuff and then like exactly. real life stuff on another email.
Yeah. I wasn't too comfortable with putting out my regular email.
Smart.
So, yeah.
You're smart. Smart player.
Thank you. Well, you know, I had to let people know because people seem to think that I was a dumb player. And there's a lot of thoughts that go on up here in this noggin when you're out there in Fiji, you know.
Jamal, ignore those people that they don't know what they're talking about. I really enjoyed getting to talk with you today because, you know, I knew that, you know, you were, you know, a very, you know, empathetic person and, you know, a great conversationalist. But I really enjoyed getting to talk with you about the game. And I like the way that you brought a lot of critical thinking to the strategic conversation and got me thinking about a lot of things that I hadn't been thinking about before.
Oh, good. I'm glad I could bring that to you, which is a huge compliment coming from you, since you have been thinking critically about this game for a very long time. And actually, I got a little bit of advice from our mutual friend, Elaine Stott.
Oh, yes. What was Elaine's advice for the podcast?
Yeah. So I told her, I was like, oh, well, give me some advice. And she was like, you know, just be you, you know, like, you don't have to be so serious all the time.
Yeah. Elaine is really great on the podcast.
Yeah, she's freaking hilarious. But she's so right. Right. And I think it's true. Like, they know me, right? The cast of season 39 at this point now, anyway, not in the beginning, but now they do. Like, they know me. I'm fun loving. I like to have a good time. I like to laugh. I like to, you know, chop it up with the best of them. So while I have my social politics and I have my, you know, big ideas about things and can speak to those issues, I also just like to be silly and laugh and have a good time with the best of them. So
yeah.
I appreciated that she encouraged me to let that side show as well.
We had some good strategy talk with Elaine, but then she just had me rolling on the floor for a good 30-40 minutes talking about everything that's going on in her world on the podcast the other day, which is really fun. If anybody didn't listen to that, if anybody listened to almost 3 hours of this and then needs more podcasts from last week, check out the podcast with Elaine. It's very fun. Jamal, thank you so much for spending so much time with me today.
No problem. Thanks so much, Rob. Really appreciate the platform and the chance to chop it up with you. Hopefully we do it again soon.
Yeah, let's do it again. Okay, Jamal?
All right. Take care.
All right, everybody. There you have it. Jamal Shibman here on the podcast. Jamal did a great job as a rookie coming in here, talking about a bunch of different stuff. Got us thinking about so many different things. I don't know. Am I naive? Is there so much smokescreen that I'm falling for on Survivor? I don't know. I'm very interested to hear what the feedback is going to be in terms of what you guys are thinking. If he's like, yes, finally, I told you, Rob, you were wrong for all this time. So looking forward to seeing what your reaction is going to be to some of the interesting Survivor subjects we talked about here today. All right, I'm going to be getting ready. What a weekend it's going to be here on the podcast, because, of course, I've got Reem Daily coming up. I'm going to talk to Reem on Sunday. Get your feedback questions in. You still got time for that. Go to robasawebsite.com/voicemail or 323-282-RHAP for that. It's the return of Rob and Akiva Need a Podcast. Talked about season 3, episode 7, but that's not what we're doing. Wheel or No Wheel is coming up after a 1 week hiatus for Rob and Akiva. So we'll be back with that on Saturday night. And then on Sunday night, Ali will be recording This Week in Survivor. Taryn Armstrong will be our guest. I will take on the robot in Jordan Kalish's This Week in Survivor History quiz. And then we'll close out the Survivor week one more time with the Wiggle Room and this week's Wand Off. All that is coming up. Rob has a website.com/iTunes to make sure you subscribe to the podcast. And so I was doing last season on the exit interview. If you left us some feedback or a, you know, comment on our Apple podcast page, and if you ask me to read it in an impression, I'm going to go back to doing that on This Week in Survivor. So I will bring that back. That was a lot of fun. Rob has a website.com/iTunes if you'd like to get more of that. And of course, for the people that want even more from Rob as a podcast, or looking for some other people to talk to about everything going on and Rob as a podcast, looking for that connection to some other people out there that are enjoying this stuff as much as you might be, head on over to robhasawebsite.com/patron. That's where you're going to get access to our Rob as a Podcast patron podcast feed. 3 patron podcasts a week right now, between the 5 for 5, the Facebook Friday, and the brand new Survivor pregame show. We started that on Wednesday night. I started an hour before the episode and had a little bit of a technical glitch at one point, but otherwise it was very fun. Get to talk to everybody, hear about who's going home, see what people are making, see what's going on an hour before the Survivor episode. We'll keep that going all through Survivor 40, and of course our patron Facebook community, and much more available to you at robhasawebsite.com/patron. Thank you so much for listening to this supersized edition here of the week 2 recap. Very much looking forward to getting into it with Reem this weekend. Thank you for listening. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.